Welcome to the Gamer Horizon Podcast. This is episode 17, recorded for May 21st, 2012. Hey, Anthony, what's going on, dude?
Not a whole lot, Alex. How about yourself?
Recording again on a Saturday morning, you know, the day before Bats Day at Disneyland. I am really excited about this.
What's what day?
Bats Day is basically the annual goth slash industrial celebration at Disneyland. So people, you know, can come visit, you know, decked out and all goth and all that stuff and, you know, just enjoy the theme park.
They have a goth day at Disneyland.
Well, okay, it's unofficial. You have to think about that. But Disneyland actually, you know, like, just kind of helps out, like, in a very minimal way so that, you know, it doesn't affect, like, other guests and stuff like that. But it's been such a tradition that they've been doing this for about 14 years now. And, you know, we're going to be, like, me and my friend are actually going to go there tomorrow at the crack of dawn to open the parks and stuff. And then, you know, like, enjoy it, have breakfast, you know, have some Mickey waffles and, you know, have fun.
Mickey waffles, that's tight.
Yeah. Yeah. They have, like, breakfast buffets and stuff. And I told my friend and she, like, her eyes just, like, widened. She's like, are you kidding me? And I'm like, yep, they have Mickey waffles. That actually exists. And she's like, all right, we're going to, like, the crack of dawn. And by the way, that's, like, you know, in case people are, like, wondering, that's, like, about literally, like, we'd be leaving in, like, Los Angeles at 7 a.m. going, and then we'll probably arrive at Disneyland, like, slightly before opening and stuff. We will literally open the park tomorrow.
Disneyland.
Yeah.
Crazy, crazy. Is there any, like, days that Disneyland is ever kind of empty or no?
That is a very good question. I think that during the week, you know, there are some days, but the thing is, that's a catch-22 because what happens is that the parks actually close earlier, like, you know, around 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, and so that's, like, you know, that's way too early, like, especially if you want to do, like, a whole day. And that, people actually don't know that. And people actually don't know that Disneyland is open from 8 a.m. to, like, midnight in a lot of cases, like, on the weekends, you know? So, yeah. So, tomorrow it's going to be really fun. I already, like, went to Hollywood Boulevard and, you know, like, bought my gothy type shit and all that. I might put on some eyeliner and black lipstick just for good measure and kind of blend in. It's gonna be a fun day. How about you, dude?
Not a whole lot. Not, just goofing off, I suppose.
Goofing off?
Yeah.
What games have you been goofing off in then?
Not a whole lot.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it's been mostly, you know, just kind of been busy and other stuff and. But
oh my God.
I will say this though. There's a couple things I do want to talk about.
Okay.
A friend of mine convinced me to finally pop in Hyperdimension Neptunia 2. Oh my God. The game.
Well, okay, so how is that game?
Okay. The combat system is pretty decent. My friend told me, and this is what I've been told by a lot of people about this particular game, is this is a sequel to Hyperdimension Neptunia.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's
yeah.
2.
Yeah, Mark 2 or MK2. From what I've been told, the first one, and he's told me, this first one is a terrible game.
Uh-huh.
It is terrible. But those that hated the first game loved the second game. The uh-huh. second game actually even got high scores from, like, IGN and stuff.
What?
Yeah. So, but there's a certain factor that's very creepy about this game. Because the main characters are basically these scantily clad girls. And I say the word girls, not women.
Yeah.
It's a very strange game. Within 5 minutes, you find these girls tied up by electronic tentacles. Need I say more?
Oh, gosh. Are you serious?
Yeah, and you know, now, mind you, there's no But still,
yeah.
They're tied up by tentacles, robotic tentacles.
So is this bordering on hentai then? I mean, like, what's going on with this game?
I don't know. Okay, the story. Okay, when you pop, this is how bizarre the game is. When you start the game, this random Japanese man in a live action video just pops out of the fuck out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
He pops the fuck out of nowhere and he gives you a warning. And he, I don't even know, it's like watch the lighting or something. It's a live action video, a video of a random Japanese guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who the hell he is. And then the story.
Isn't Itagaki in this game?
No, Inafune
is in this game. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, here's the story, okay? The story is there's this world called game industry. And mm-hmm. what's interesting about it, this is a game to take note, is what I find fascinating is it's a commentary. As goofy and as perverted as this game is, it's a commentary, it seems, on the Japanese game industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a satire and it's a commentary on it. Basically, the story is, and what's funny is it talks about things in this game that you've talked about the Japanese game industry.
Really? Like what?
Okay, like the intro basically goes, "Welcome to game industry, a once magical world. Game industry has fallen under hard times, overworked people, outdated practices, and just all kinds of stuff." Right? And basically, the evil nightmare world from the Western lands has come to overtake it.
Wow. Okay.
So essentially, they're like all these. Now, what's funny is actual game companies from Japan are represented in this game, including Concept, Inafune's new company. I think it's mm-hmm. Concept. Is it Concept?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Cave is involved.
Weird.
NIS, all kinds of
So are they developers in this world? Like, are they companies? Are they governments or factions?
They're kind of like factions. They're all represented by this girl.
Okay.
By one of these girls in the game.
Oh, I see.
So they all have a representative and they have powers that are representative of that. Like, the Cave is kind of a bullet hell type character.
Okay.
And basically, it's what's funny is it's just a commentary. Now, I haven't played it a whole lot. I've been watching some videos, and I may get into this. Considering my game outline, I'm actually very interested in this game just because it seems like it's just a sort of self-aware commentary on the current state of the Japanese game industry.
Okay,
I think that's what's fascinating me the most about it. You look past the anime characters, you look past the anime girls, and you actually have a very smart satire mm-hmm. on the state of the Japanese game industry. And I don't think you see commentaries like that in any from any developer or any way, shape, or form on the game industry in general.
Yeah,
and I think that's what's fascinating. It is critical of the Japanese game industry.
Well, as critical as, you know, like girls with tentacles, like, you know, like wrapped around them can be.
Yeah. But I think all of that, it makes fun of those quirks of the Japanese game industry. I think that's what's unique about it.
So you think it's also makes fun of like all the Japanese tropes that, you know, that they know exists in their industry? Because that would actually be kind of neat for them to kind of address, just to kind of say like, okay, well, obviously we're all about tentacles and, you know, cutesy, wootsy anime characters with big ass eyes and stuff like that. And, you know, and this is kind of like, you know, this is how we can save ourselves and individualize ourselves from the rest of the world kind of thing, you know?
It seems like it's going down that path.
Okay.
It seems like it is. I mean, everything about it is, I mean, it's a ridiculous game. It's probably, from what I played of it yesterday, it's probably one of the most ridiculous games I've ever seen or played.
Okay.
But it's also smart about what it's trying to do. It's kind of like what I would, and this is going to sound ridiculous to you. But it's kind of like what Saints Row the Third does in its own way. Saints Row the Third, I think, is also a satire on gaming itself. Maybe not necessarily the game industry,
mm-hmm.
but it makes fun of of gaming tropes, all gaming tropes.
Yeah.
And I think it also is a commentary on this current state. And what I mean about that is it just shows how, like, what's good about good satire or good parody is you realize how ridiculous things really are.
Yeah.
And Saints Row the Third makes you think, wow, you know, these are in games that take themselves seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But they're actually really goofy. And it's the same thing in this. You know, you realize, you know, the Japanese game developers are kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, they're totally completely different games, but there's a certain self-awareness there.
Yeah, I forgot to mention this in a previous episode of the podcast, but I played the Gangsters in Space expansion, and that is, like, wholly self-aware, making fun of video games and movies and stuff as far as, you know, the action genre is concerned. And I totally love that because it really kind of made it, you know, kind of brought to light the ridiculousness of action movies and all that stuff. But, you know, I'm a big fan of that genre, and that hasn't really diminished, like, my enjoyment of those. It's just funny that when, you know, like what you said, when somebody, like, makes fun of it in a very satirical and very kind of, you know, almost really kind of calculated kind of way, you can't help but kind of laugh at it and stuff because you know exactly what they're parodying.
Exactly. And if you need any more evidence, if you're in doubt that what I'm saying is bullshit, that it's not you, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That it's bullshit that that this is a commentary in the game industry. Inafune's involved in this game.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's probably more critical than fucking than Fish.
Actually, they're both just as critical. I think, like, Inafune said something about Phil Fish's statements and stuff, and how I think he agrees with him or something about it. But, you know, like, again, you know, it's interesting to kind of see this game kind of come out, but I'm more excited about what you think of the overall game, because, I mean, you're not that far into it, and, you know, I'm just looking forward to seeing, like, how far this game takes all those ideas you mentioned.
See, I'm kind of torn now because what happened was now, mind you, I will say I'm still playing Tales, but I'm not going to say anything about it.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, I want to talk about it as a complete product.
Yeah.
I'm really slogging through that game. It's not because it's bad. It's because of lack of time.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, and Tales games are long, so that doesn't help. What I am torn because I was planning on doing Ghost Recon, and I didn't want to get RPG burned out. And mind you, let's keep in mind this is what Hyperdimension Neptunia is.
Mm-hmm.
It is a fucking role playing game, nonetheless.
So even though you have, like, these characters from Cave and Comcept and all that stuff, these guys are represented just by, like, an avatar of sorts, and their presence is basically represented by a girl, and that doesn't really necessarily mean that their gameplay, whatever their gameplay is reflected in the game itself. It's still, right, like a turn-based RPG at the end of the day.
Right, and you see tons of references from their games.
I see.
I mean, if you're familiar with this guy, Prinnies are a fucking summon.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can summon Prinnies. I mean, Inafune.
So who developed this game?
Ah, shit. That is a good question. I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, because, I mean, what I'm curious about this is that it kind of reminds me of the other kind of crossover RPG that we saw. Like, I think it wasn't last year, but I think it's a year before, where it's like Namco cross Capcom. Oh, no. It's an RPG that they announced last year, but I know that they've made, like, a versus game before that was actually a turn-based RPG as well.
I don't know.
Yeah, because I know that, you know, and then, of course, you know, something with Nintendo, Sega, and Capcom, and Namco, which is kind of ridiculous. It's like, it's very creative in some ways, and I really kind of encourage that sort of thought process, but like, it seems like, you know, their collaborations are kind of bordered on either, like, okay, well, let's make a fighting game, or let's make a JRPG, which I want to see them, like, do other stuff too, like, in just, you know, right, in my case and stuff, you know. But do you know who made this game? Let me
think. Yeah, I found out.
Okay.
It is Idea Factory and Compile Heart.
Okay, so basically, yeah, so not Cave, or obviously not any of those companies. Okay.
Yeah, but here are the companies that are involved. Okay.
Okay.
Let's see. The companies that are representative is Cave, Falcom, Jamuji K,
mm-hmm.
Leebox. Okay. It's kind of vague. It's kind of vague, but those are just some of the companies. Comcept.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just some of the companies represented in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Mega Man reference. Basically, the plot is the year is 20XX.
Okay.
Mega Man reference.
Jeez.
You know.
Yeah, because, I mean, okay, so this is the one that I was kind of thinking about. The game that they made before was Cross Edge.
I've heard horrible things about Cross Edge.
Yeah, it's a tactical RPG. That has characters from, like, you know, Darkstalkers, and just Gaia, Atelier Marie, you know, and Tekken. You know, it's part of that kind of crossover type idea, and that's kind of like what I kind of saw, you know, like when I kind of looked at this game, was that kind of thing where it's like, oh, that's kind of neat. So, but yeah, again, like I'm kind of excited to see like what you think about this game, like once you finally actually play it like full time and stuff and whatnot, you know?
Yeah, there's just that problem of RPG fatigue, and I want to play The Witcher very badly.
Yeah.
But this has intrigued me just because of the concept.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I bought the game and I didn't know. I just thought, oh, you know, some JRPG that I could burn time off.
Okay. So let's talk about, you know, I think we need to talk about Future Soldier and kind of like what details you know of it. Because, I mean, for me, like I know that there is a beta out, but I never really played it. And I know we kind of glossed over it in previous episodes.
Yeah, Future Soldier.
Yeah, so what do you, like, how are you liking it? Like, have you been playing the demo at all? Like,
I haven't played the beta recently, but I have played it sometime. I will say they've got a good cover system.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's probably one of the most, it's one of the better cover mechanics I've seen. I haven't had much trouble with it like I have had in other games, Gears of War and things like that.
Right.
It's, you know, there's the camo aspect, which is kind of an invisibility type thing.
So how does that work? Can you use it forever, or is it one of those things where you have like a time limit?
It's very limited. You have to use it. Like, when I remember first seeing the trailers for this fucking game,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, oh, they're going to fucking overuse it or something.
Uh-huh.
No, you have to use it sparingly, in true Ghost Recon tradition, I suppose.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot more in the full game.
Okay.
There's going to be a lot more. One thing I'm excited to play with, and you can play with in the beta, is the gun customization.
Yeah. I don't think you talked about that before. So how does that work? Like, I'm more kind of curious about the ease of use of it, because the thing is, when I imagine customizing a gun, I mean, that could be anything. Like, that could be something really stupidly complicated, you know, like Legos and stuff. Or that could be something like as simple as like, here's a menu item, here's this, combine them together, you get this, you know?
We've seen gun customization in games before, but I don't think ever on this level, not at least myself.
Okay.
The only other game I can think that it's comparable to, and mind you, this is a JRPG, is possibly Resonance of Fate, but this probably even takes it further.
Oh, wow.
Because Resonance of Fate, if you remember, being that it is a tri-ace of all, you know, developers,
mm-hmm.
tri-ace developed JRPG, had a very deep gun customization system.
Yeah.
This game, on the other hand, probably, I mean, this is for somebody like a gunsmith to play with.
Mm-hmm.
It is overly complicated. I will say this, though. There are ways to, you know, figure out what gun's perfect. If you're like me, you're a dumbass about guns.
Mm-hmm.
You could just figure out what gun's perfect and leave it be.
Okay.
But you can customize it. And most games, like even Call of Duty and stuff, most of it, it's like, oh, you want a laser sight, hologram sight,
mm-hmm.
you know, scope sight,
mm-hmm.
you know, short barrel, longer barrel. No, this goes to the fucking gears.
Oh, wow.
this determines everything from kickback to fucking every little thing, handling, weight, everything.
Oh, wow.
It's nuts.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. So, like, do you see any potential for people to abuse this system, though?
I haven't ran into any balance issues. In fact, that's one thing I like about the Ghost Recon series was balance issues. The only time I've had any problems with it was when I first played Advanced Warfighter. Spawn killing was very easy to do in that game.
I see, yeah.
That was that game's flaw in multiplayer. And there was an option to prevent it, but if you notice, most people had it turned off.
Right.
And if you opened the game with that option, like a 5-minute invulnerability, 5-second invulnerability, excuse me, people would not join your game. Because that's how people exploited it. So, but I don't see any of that in this.
Well, that's good.
That's good. I think that's fixed out. I don't see any. From what I've seen, I don't see any, you know, camping issues or any, you know, anything like that so far.
Okay.
Any exploits of any kind.
I guess we'll see it like once the actual game comes out. It's coming out this week, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll be talking about it next episode. I will say this though, the beta I think uses 2 maps.
Uh huh.
So mind you, these are 2 maps out of, you know, how many are in the main game.
Uh huh.
And who knows? You know what? Who knows what the other maps are like?
Yeah, I'm really excited for you for this game because I know you've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Yeah, Ghost Recon is a series that I, you know, as much as I follow, say, a Final Fantasy, I follow Ghost Recon as much as I do that.
Yeah,
kind of funny, you know, just how different those games are. But
yeah,
the thing about Ghost Recon is that there's a certain level of realism that's not. It has a level of realism that I feel is missing from a lot of games. Now, mind you, I don't go to games looking for realistic stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's what sets Ghost Recon apart. You know, I could go there for something a bit different than what your norm is. And that's where that intensity factor comes in. There's, you know, you're not a bullet sponge.
Mm-hmm. And I think that what you probably mean is this, just a kind of relative realism that the Ghost Recon series kind of affords. Because, I mean, you still have those futuristic kind of sci-fi elements to it.
Yeah.
But I think that serves more for the gameplay because you're not physically there than actually, like, you know, like, just being futuristic for the sake of being futuristic,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Like, you know, it's not like, let's just add robots, you know, or it's like, you know, UVAs and things like that.
UAVs and stuff?
UAVs, yeah. I don't know what I call it. UAVs. UAVs and, you know, the camo.
Yeah.
Which has very limited use.
And those are kind of techs that actually they're researching right now, like the refractive, you know, light, you know, camouflage. That's actually being researched right now, which is kind of scary.
From what I understand, and I could be completely wrong, I remember reading this somewhere that Ubisoft actually got together with some of the people who are developing some of these technologies.
Do you think that's real though, or like PR? Because sometimes like
I don't know.
Even with Treyarch, when they said like, oh well, we met up with some people and stuff like that. That just made me like look like, huh? You know, but it's like, it's kind of cool that they are kind of taking this time to do this. But, you know, like thinking about it and stuff, it probably costs a lot of money to try to like get those people, you know?
Well, let's be honest here. How many times this, you know, we talk about, we lambast the shit out of Final Fantasy 13 Versus. We don't, you know, we talk about Duke Nukem, you know, and all this. How many times has this game been delayed?
Oh, shit. Years?
I think this game was... Fuck, I'll just make sure. I think this game was... I remember seeing it way back at E3 2010.
Yeah.
I think...
Yeah, it's been kind of canceled, like, over and over, and just kind of pushed back and pushed back. And I think that's kind of good in some ways, because, like, they're just not pushing a product out the door. Because I think that, you know... like developers are slowly realizing and publishers are slowly realizing if they try to push something out the door, it's not necessarily going to make like it's probably not even going to make, you know, like break even in some cases. I'm not talking about specifically like, you know, like Ghost Recon. I'm talking about like games in general, because you're asking so much already of gamers by charging it like $60. I mean, you know, it's either your game or somebody else's, I would think.
Right. Well, here's when it was announced to be in development.
Mm-hmm.
January 22nd, 2009.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, I remember one time they were saying, oh, you know, what, you know, October 2009, then it was, you know, early 2010,
and in 2011.
It was even supposed to come out last fall at one point, I think.
Yeah.
So who knows? They are doing a lot of things too to promote this game.
Yeah.
There is a short movie called Ghost Recon Alpha. I haven't seen it. I probably will watch it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a ghost team, and they're trying to secure a RSM-56 Bulava nuclear. And it just explains, you know, it just ends with what leads into the game. And basically the story is a dirty bomb has taken out a ghost team, and another ghost team is tasked with tracking down the source of the dirty bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like I said, you're not going to, don't expect deep character development or anything like this.
Yeah, don't expect this to be like Call of Duty, where they have like an overarching story that, you know, there is the mission, and that's really the most important thing about it. And don't get too trapped in that, because the strength of Ghost Recon is just the gritty realism that it portrays. Like, it's, I would even kind of say, like, you know, like, this is pretty much like the only game that kind of takes it to this level of realism, I would say.
It's kind of like, well, it's based off all these teams, like, you know, the Navy SEALs, the team that assassinated, well, not killed, whatever you want to call, Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. You know, it's based off that type of play, because when they go on these missions, these are not like, oh, you know, group of army invasion. You know, these are small, heavily armed teams that rely on stealth to some degree.
Yeah.
Because that's one thing. Ghost Recon actually has to have an element of stealth.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about these games, too, is remember your equipment. You have guns that your rate of fire has to change. This is not a game where you could, you know, just have a machine gun and rely on that, mm-hmm, and not use your sidearm or anything. You have to actually change your rate of fire depending on different situations. There are times when you do not want your enemy to see you.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not saying this is Splinter Cell or Metal Gear,
mm-hmm,
because you can engage in operable, you know,
yeah,
game battles. I mean, you know, you can get into firefights, unlike those games, but there's a certain, okay, level of stealth to them, too. So I don't know. What's your experience on Ghost Recon?
Well, the Ghost Recon series kind of like pulled me in when I was playing through, like, you know, Advanced Warfighter. And I really liked that series and stuff, like, for the amount of realism that it gets. Like, you know, like, one of the things that I really loved about the game is that when you're running, there's just this, you know, this whole feeling of weight when you're like kind of going from cover to cover with this character, and you can just like the sound effects too, like, you know, like all the equipment kind of like tinkling and clinking and clanking and stuff, like as you're like running. I thought that, you know, that alone has like a very distinct kind of feel of like, all right, you're at war, you are in this kind of war zone. This is, you know, this is do or die, guys. You know, it's really cool. And I've always admired that in the Ghost Recon series. It's just that for me, you know, like personally, like, I like those kinds of games, but I generally don't finish them because I need a more engaging story. But with that said, like, if, you know, if it did have something like that, I'm not talking about like, you know, like a full on Call of Duty, like, you know, big, you know, like action
movie.
The
Call of Duty game, other than Black Ops, their stories are ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, they're even not. Black Ops to a degree is kind of ridiculous, but it's like, you know, Black Ops was the only one that kind of tried to legitimize the storyline by actually having the main character talk instead of being a deaf mute half the time. You know,
shit.
You know, because half the time, like, the Modern Warfare guy doesn't even talk.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or actually the whole time he doesn't even talk. He basically grunts. yeah.
But couple things before we switch. Just want to let you know, here's some gameplay changes, okay?
Uh-huh.
These got me excited. Okay, cover You there's a cover system, but while in cover, players can be suppressed when under fire by an enemy machine gun. The field of vision will decrease and the camera will shake, making it harder to return fire.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so that's one. There's the camo, which, again, you can use. It's very limited. And even in the game story, it says that the camo is a prototype.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know...
It's not reliable all the time.
Right. Another big change is, unlike other Ghost Recon changes, the players will not micromanage their squad. Instead, the player can mark targets. During firefights, the player can mark one high-priority target on which squad members should focus fire. Outside of firefights, up to four targets can be marked for a synchronized shot. The ghost will automatically choose a target and move into position to take this target out. When the player gives the command, or when the player shoots their own target, all other ghosts will simultaneously shoot their targets. Then, last, players will also be able to control drones. Some drones have been confirmed, such as the drone crawler, a small remote-controlled quad rotor which can land and drive sound, and the Warhound, a heavy walking robot similar to Big Dog, which can be used as portable cover.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's gunsmiths. And, of course, gunsmith, you know, under the barrel, side barrel attachments, work on all that, so.
Yeah. So, yeah, it sounds like it's really comprehensive.
It sounds like a full game. I mean, allegedly there's millions of combinations or something.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you unlock weapons, and then you take the parts from the weapons and you mix them with other weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, as you play through the game, you may unlock a machine gun, you may unlock a submachine gun, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And then you kind of, and once you unlock the weapons, you get all their parts too.
I see.
And then you unlock credits to buy more things and stuff like that, so.
Mm-hmm.
That's Ghost Recon.
Awesome.
I don't know. I'm passing Max Payne for this shit.
I know. That's a pretty tall order, my friend.
It'll be a good game. How come you're passing on it?
What? Future Soldier?
Yeah.
I think I mentioned it already. My history with the Future Soldiers, well, just Ghost Recon in general, is not, again, it's not because it's a bad game, but I need more to kind of push myself to finish it. And I find myself having that right now with a lot of JRPGs. It's just, you know, my interest level has to be really high, and really, the games really need to invest me in the storyline in order for me to finish them. And, you know... And it kind of sucks because that means, like, I haven't finished a lot of my games. But the thing is, when I do finish my games, it's, like, really, like, full on, like, okay, I understand everything and I, like, will replay it and stuff. It's, like, I buy games mostly to research also and to kind of be aware of, like, what people like in them and stuff. As far as Ghost Recon is concerned, like, I'm just, like, I am a fan of Graw, which is a great game, but I'm not invested in the series enough to be like, okay, well, Future Soldier over Max Payne 3 or over Dragon's Dogma and stuff. Because even though I am like a Western RPG guy, as you would say, I wouldn't say that I'm fully a Western RPG or Western kind of player.
I don't know if you're a fully Western RPG guy. I don't think you are, because I think you're more critical of them than you are JRPGs in some degrees. I think, like, especially Bethesda games.
Well, I think that's both of us, to be honest.
Well, we've talked about that before, so I'm not going to get into it, but yes. I'm just saying, I really think, you know, we're a lot more lenient on the JRPG, but, you know, like you said, with Ghost Recon, let's, you know, which is not a JRPG by any means, it's going to be, the thing about Max Payne 3, I don't know, I've never been a big fan of Max Payne, so.
Uh-huh.
I liked the first game, and that's about it. The second game, I couldn't get into.
Well, actually, a lot of people didn't get into part two. Which is kind of funny, because I heard, like, it's out on Xbox Live Arcade.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's really weird. Like, that's like, the fall of Max Payne, which is, I've never actually played through it. I played through the first game. I thought that was good. Max Payne 2, yeah, I actually really like the storyline also, but, like, it's kind of like, I like the technological advances that they have in that game, but apart from that, you know, it wasn't a game that was too pleasant to play.
Right.
I guess because of the storyline, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of this, like, I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's kind of, I don't want to spoil it because people are going to play it, but, you know, you guys will see it once you play it and stuff. So,
well, So what have you been playing?
Okay, before we get into Max Payne 3, because I know you're trying to segue into that. Plants vs. Zombies is still back on my, you know, on my gaming life. That is just getting really fucking hilarious. Like, the zombies have basically, like, full-on want to destroy me. There are zombies that are going into my pool, and actually they are, and some of them are actually riding dolphins now.
What the fuck?
Yeah, to jump over other plants. I'm like, what the fuck? What are you doing? Also, there are zombies that strap themselves with balloons so that they can float over all, like, the ammo and stuff. So you have to build this kind of cactus that extends itself high enough so it can pop the balloon so that they can it can drop them on the ground. There are zombies that have pickaxes that can actually, like, dig underneath all your plants and go behind them and go the opposite way to kill all your plants. So you need plants that actually shoot backward. And they do give you a lot of ammo as far as, like, what kind of plants you can plant. There's, like, a plant that has, like, a magnet on it.
Right.
And what that does is it actually grabs pails, pickaxes, and different kinds of metallic, you know, kind of, you know, pieces and stuff so that, you know, zombies can't use them. So they become just regular zombies just going back and forth. Then there's football zombies that are basically have like twice the amount of ammo and they're really tough. They cause a lot of damage. But the plants are just as interesting. They have plants that shoot in five different directions. They have, like, you know, plants that shoot water, you know. And the current stage that I'm in, because you go, basically the story is a very light one. And it's really ridiculous that I basically said that, oh, I'm not playing Ghost Recon because there's no overarching story. Because Plants vs. Zombies, this is the story. Zombies want to eat your brains. Period.
Wow, Alex, that's engaging.
I know, right? Very engaging, very deep. Like, but what I like about this is that there's comedy to it, and they're not afraid of actually being, you know, being like really pushing what our definition of zombies are and just really kind of running with it. And I think that that's kind of like the charm of this game. And the same thing with the plants. I mean, when you have plants, there are certain scenarios that are only available to them. Like, for example, like in the evening, obviously the sunflowers wouldn't generate that much sun. It would be useless. So you basically have to plant a different kind of plant. And there's different costs depending on like what plant you get. And also there are certain plants that aren't even available in the daytime. So with that said, you have to kind of manage and figure out what plants would be kind of effective depending on the time of day. You know, because there are plants that are available in the day. Some are not available in the evening. Right now, I am in the fifth area, which is actually the rooftop of your house.
Oh shit!
Yeah. So basically, the zombies have basically, you know, kind of said like, okay, well, you know what? You have your front lawn completely covered. You have your back lawn completely covered. We're gonna take it to the fucking rooftops now, and we'll see if you fucking stop us with your stupid plants and shit. And I'm like, I just freaking stopped there, and I was like, are you fucking crazy? It just
that
laughed my ass
insane.
Off. I couldn't believe it. Like, I was like, why am I my roof, the roof of my house?
I did play a little bit of it.
Yeah?
A little bit of it.
How far did you get?
Nah, not very far.
But I
will play more of it. I do have it on the Vita, but I was not intending to buy it on the Vita.
Uh-huh.
I think I told the story, didn't I?
Yeah, I think so. Your kid actually accidentally bought it?
No, he didn't accidentally bought it. He legitimately bought it. my credit card was on there, and I forgot to put a password. I never knew he was going to buy it. He got in the Vita, and he bought $55 and stuff. Not only did he buy Plants vs. Zombies,
uh-huh,
he also bought Lego Harry Potter years 5 through 7.
Oh shit!
which is, you know what? I do. My kid knows, he's 6, but he knows how to handle the game, so I let him play the Vita and stuff. Takes good care of him.
Uh-huh.
He, for a 6-year-old, I've disciplined him to do that. Uh-huh. You know, he has a Wii. He puts his games in the cases. He knows how to take care of them.
Yes.
He does the same with the Vita, and he knows how to play it. He plays Lego Harry Potter on there years 5 through 7.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I, you know, I have no desire to play, so. Mm-hmm. Oh, speaking of the Vita, I just want to add, as we are recording this, I do have Mortal Kombat downloading on it.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's going to be fun.
Yep, yep. I heard. I guess there's enough incentive to get that version.
You know, the challenge tower, specifically made for the Vita, as kitschy as a lot of the challenges are, like, you know, like, ooh, like, wipe the blood off of the screen while you're fighting, it's actually really fun.
Oh, shit.
Like, it's not like, okay, it's not like hardcore fighting game, you know, fighter kind of fun, where you're, like, learning the combos, doing the fatalities and all that stuff, but it's just straight up fun when you have nothing to do, like, on a commute or something like that, and, or, you know, when you're waiting for class, you know, to break and stuff, just, you know, just start playing it, and then, you know, it's a good kind of time waster. There's a lot of really neat ideas there.
I think the thing about Mortal Kombat is, for years, it's been dogged on.
Mm-hmm.
Unfairly, I think, in some ways, and I think the true, like, back in the 90s, you and I remember this era. You know, Street Fighter 2 came on the scene.
Yeah.
And while Street Fighter 2 had a lot of competitors that were more on par with it, Mortal Kombat was considered its real competitor.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be honest, Mortal Kombat did not have a deep system.
Yeah.
In reality, it was mostly because of the gore back in those days.
Right.
What I think has happened with the franchises, Ed Boon and those guys have realized, you know, let's add depth, but let's keep what makes Mortal Kombat fun.
Mm-hmm.
Let's, you know, let's make it this kind of a dark game with, at times, what's funny about Mortal Kombat is it's this very bleak and brutal game,
mm-hmm.
but then, you know, but then when you get down to it, it's kind of goofy at the same time, and it works, and you still can take it seriously, but not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the sometimes, you know, the fatalities are just cruel, and sometimes they're just hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you start getting the stuff like Bibalities and friendships, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and when Mortal Kombat came last year, that's the biggest thing you could do to piss someone off online.
Yeah,
like one guy I remember, I turned him into a, I fought him six times, and every time I turned him into a baby.
Oh,
and he sent me all kinds of hate messages.
I know.
They get pit, like, fatalities, they do get pissed, but people really get pissed when you turn them into a baby.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I actually did that, like, on the home console version of Mortal Kombat. People, like, were pissed. They'd, like, rage quit before the game is over. I just laugh my ass off.
Oh, shit.
I have a pretty mean Melina in that game. Really
yes,
mean.
Yes, you do.
Yes.
Yeah, I know you do. I know you do, because you beat me with it pretty badly. But, yeah, so that, back to Plants vs. Zombies. Can I say one thing about that game?
Yeah.
Because I know we went off topic. I'm sorry. But
it's okay. It happens. It happens.
It happens all the time.
All the time.
Do not buy it on the Vita, though.
Uh-huh.
Because it's $15.
Yeah.
You can buy it on iPhone for $3 or $4 or something.
I don't know what the price is, because obviously I purchased it, so it hides the price. But I would get it on a portable platform. Like, it...
Not on the Vita, though, because it's not worth $15.
The Vita's pretty expensive, I'll get you that. But if that's the only way that you can play it, I would probably still recommend it. Because it is, I think it's, I want to say, like, when it first came out, it was like $20 on the PC and Mac. Basically, you know what? I would even recommend this on any platform that you have. Because the game is good enough to kind of warrant how much they're charging for it on any platform. But, you know, get it on any platform that you can. Because... You know, or wherever you want to play it on. Like, for me, like, I got it on iOS, and it's just, it's really difficult because I have, like a, kind of like a screen protector, not a screen protector, but like a case for my iPhone, so it kind of prevents me on pressing certain areas and stuff, but I also have it on my iPad, and that one's actually, like, a joy to actually play, and I think for a time, they were giving out, like, 10,000 coins and stuff, but I don't know, like, I have to figure out what the difference is between the two.
If you have more than one portal, if you have the Vita and other platforms, get it on there, because it's just cheaper.
Yeah, get it on a platform that's cheaper, period. Because it's not gonna set... You know, they haven't sacrificed any quality because it's cheaper.
No, no, no. It's the same game. I'm just saying, you know,
yeah.
I wouldn't buy it on the Vita if, you know.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. So.
But are you, so you're enjoying the game? Because I can't wait until you actually get to the part where I'm at, because you'd just be like, dude, dude, this is like this is like the most craziest and most fun, like, you know, defense game I ever played.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, remember at the end there is a kind of like a karaoke sing-along part, I think, that happens at the end. Because back in the day, like, the way that they marketed this is that they released a YouTube video of a sunflower singing. Like, singing to a song called Zombies in My Lawn.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that's actually how I learned about the game, and I immediately got it. And I'm like, this game is awesome! Yeah.
Plants vs. Zombies. So, yes. How about that Max Payne, then?
How about the other game, the Max Payne game? You know, the one that just came out, like, this last week, you know?
Oh, by the way, none of us, just to let you know, if you're gonna, so you don't have to ask us, I do not plan on buying Diablo 3.
Yeah, I am skipping out on Diablo 3 because right now I am playing through the Torchlight 2 beta.
And that's you know, there's no DRM. Or maybe there is, I don't know.
Well, I don't know if it does, but either way, from what I've played of Torchlight 2, like, and I mentioned this already last week, it's still a really fun game. I haven't really gotten to the nitty-gritty of it. I like the customizability of the pets. I like that you can customize your character now very lightly, but a lot more than the other games and stuff. Even Diablo, for that matter, you can't change your character and stuff too much, except for the armor and stuff. But, you know, there's differences between the two. And once the full version is out, I will probably buy Diablo 3 then so that I can make comparisons. And I did go into the Diablo 3 beta, and it is a good game. It's a really fun game to play with friends, but we will talk more about Diablo 3 when we get to the news.
Okay.
Right now, so, I want to talk about Max Payne 3.
I just wanted to stress we're not playing Diablo 3, though, so...
Yeah, well, yeah. But I did play the beta. I also wanted to stress that.
Oh, okay.
So...
That's right, you did play the beta. Okay, so Max Payne.
Max Payne 3 is... And by Max Payne 3 is made by the guys who made Bully, which is Rockstar Vancouver. So just to kind of get that out of the way. So there is like this really strong pedigree there, because Rockstar Vancouver is probably, of all the previous gen Rockstar developers, they're the only ones that basically made a Rockstar game that had really deep character development and a really good overarching storyline and a pretty believable world. Now, people were going to be like, oh, what are we talking about? There's San Andreas, there's Vice City, those are memorable characters, blah, blah, blah. But not in the same degree as how Vancouver did Bully. Because
I think Bully was when Rockstar started its current serious storytelling streak.
Yeah, because, I mean, Bully is very lighthearted too, but not in the crazy kind of loosely lighthearted way that, you know, some of the previous Grand Theft Autos were. Like, they had fully modeled faces that actually were, you know, actually exist in a particular, like, you know, art style. It's not just blocks that are just kind of, like, made, you know, like, kind of obscurely into, like, a person or something like that. Like, they actually had facial features. You can see reactions and stuff. And it was so good that when they ported it to the Xbox 360 for the Scholarship Edition, it still looked good. You know? It stood the test of time, basically, in that way. And the world that you existed in was pretty realistic. You know, it's a small town, but, you know, there's, like, kind of like a social group that was happening there. The little kind of packs and stuff. Anyways, you know, if you haven't played Bully, I would probably go get it. It is still on my PS2. It is one of my prized possessions. You know, and I don't say that a lot for Rockstar games and stuff, but, like... That game is, like, to me, the height of the previous generation. That was, like, when they said, this is a glimpse of the direction we're going to take Rockstar in the next generation. And I'm glad to still own the original version of it. Because it only came out on PS2 originally, so...
Right.
You know. So, going to Max Payne 3, you would think, but it's not an open-world game anymore. Maybe they'll lose all of that. Nope. That is actually the complete opposite, like, of what this is. You know, I mentioned on Twitter that you can tell the quality of a game based on how they present the game from the very beginning till the very end. When you start Max Payne 3, you get the logo, you get the familiar kind of, if you played the previous games, the familiar like painkiller kind of sound effect where you're like drinking it and stuff, you know, just to kind of show off the Rockstar logo. But when you get to the title screen, it doesn't have anything else other than the logo and press start. And what's interesting is, like, that's when I was, like, I kind of knew, like, I, you know, that I needed to sit down on my couch and prepare myself for a ride, you know, because this is going to be like some insane shit. So I press start, and, you know, next thing you know, you see, like, you know, Max Payne coming through like a doorway and stuff, this kind of like kind of nice apartment, and, you know,
right,
in Brazil and stuff, and you hear the familiar Max Payne sound, you know, the whole opening song, and I was like, all right, we are back, you know. And the voice actor, they got the same voice actor from Max Payne 1 and 2.
Nice.
Mind you, it's been a decade since we've heard this guy, and he, it sounds like he hasn't missed a beat. He is Max Payne through and through. And, you know, and he, and as usual in the Max Payne fashion, you know, he narrates his life, his thoughts, his stuff, and you really get a good overview of who he is as an individual and what powers him and what is driving him right now to what he does. You know, he is a broken man. He is older. He is worn down. He still thinks of the death of his wife, which, by the way, if you haven't played the first game, well, that's really it. And really catches us up to where he is. And he finally sits down. He, you know, he has like a glass of, you know, alcohol, you know, in his, you know, in his armchair and stuff. And then the menu pops up.
Right.
And I'm like, they took about 5 minutes to establish the character before you even get to pick like what mode of the game you actually have to pick from. Like, not even, you don't see single player, you don't see multiplayer right away. You see that story section, and then boom, you are literally in his world.
Oh shit.
So that few minutes that you spend learning about Max Payne's past and really kind of getting the mood of the game, you know, and what he is and who he is as a character, sets you up for like this really incredible action game. Like, I'm not talking about like a Call of Duty crazy action game. I'm talking about this really well-made action movie with like this main character that is just, you can kind of relate to, because every one of us has had challenges in their lives, but his is just really unique and really kind of, you know, really crazy. Like, you know, he doesn't like his job where he is. He's been kind of, you know, he's been kind of finagled into like joining this thing. And there's a lot of kind of parallels basically saying, yeah, it's been a long time, Max, which kind of is parallels and is very meta to like what really happened. You know, it's been a long time. We haven't seen Max in a long time. He's haggard. He's kind of, you know, he's kind of rusty. So, you know, and because of that, there's a lot of elements in the gameplay that tie into that, and I'll get into that later and stuff. So
you like the game?
Well, I want to talk more about the game, but I want to give you a chance to kind of ask me about it, because obviously, just like, isn't that crazy though that they took that time instead of giving you the menu from the title screen, they want to give you an idea who you're playing as?
Yeah.
Before, you know, is that, to me, that adds a lot to it, like that whole sequence. Like, it's crazy that they're ballsy enough to be like, okay, here's the title screen, start, menu. You know, it's not that. There's, like, a little sequence. Like, that to me is, like, one, like, that, it just shows you the attention to detail that they have. And mind you, you didn't like the first two games, but I can guarantee you that you'll like this, because it's not noir, which people actually lambast and stuff, like, a lot of the old fans, it's not noir, but I feel that a lot of the elements that make Max Payne still exist in this game, like the bullet time, it's not comic book based anymore, the cutscenes. It's more like a real cutscene using the engine.
But it's
motion based. So it's kind of like reading a graphic novel, like, you know, that's on the iPad that actually has moving pictures and stuff. It has that kind of feel to it. And it does have those cuts, kind of like in 24, or even like in certain like action movies by Michael Mann and stuff, where it has like, you know, they divide the screen into half, and then, you know, there's like an action happening up above or to the side and stuff. You know, it's really clever in its narrative storytelling. And also, like, you know, they do things that make it comic booky, like certain important words they actually highlight and pop up on screen.
Yeah.
You know, while you're doing it. And so it's really, they thought a lot about how they can own the Max Payne franchise as their own, and I think that they struck a really good chord as far as the storytelling aspect of it.
Yeah, it seems like that. I was going to ask you about, in terms of the story itself. In terms of the story itself, is there a lot of like twists?
It's a pretty straightforward storyline. You're basically in Brazil. You're hired by this kind of rich guy to basically oversee the protection of him and his family and stuff. Because, you know, they're pretty important people in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And, you know, as in typical action movie fashion, you know, things go awry, you know, and you have to kind of, you know, save, you know, them and stuff. And that's just the first mission. I'm not gonna say the outcome of it, but basically this leads you to try to figure out who is after that family and why they're doing this. And the twist basically just came when I played through chapter 3, and I'm in chapter 4 right now. So chapter 3 had a twist, and I'm not gonna say the twist because, you know, but basically there are twists and turns and stuff like that. But one thing that's interesting that they did before the main menu actually appeared is they actually showed you what seems to be the last scene of the game.
Right.
And, you know, it just kind of brings you back to, I think that happens before the
kind of like that movie menu. Michael Clayton, where you see him get in the car and the car explodes.
Yeah,
and it flashes back.
Yeah, to what happened. Yeah, it's exactly that. You know, not exactly the same scene, but like it's something similar to that.
Uncharted 2 did that too, kind of
in a way. So you basically see the guy, and this is incredible. The bad guy, whoever he is basically, his face is mangled. You can't even tell who he is. He has a bloody stump for a hand. You know, he's completely bloodied. Max Payne is completely, you know, like in pain. He's got scars all over the place. You see parts of his body, you know, not parts of his body, but like you see him scarred and just totally banged up and beat up and stuff. You see a plane in the background on fire. And he's just slowly walking after this guy while this guy tries to crawl away. And then he's like, you know, he's basically saying, you know, I'm going to, you know, as I approach my victim to pull the gun on his head, I was like, oh, man, this is like, what a tease. Like, what a tease to get you to push through the entire 10 hours of this game. That's what people are clocking it with, you know, to try to get to that point, to that same scene.
A 10-hour game.
Yeah, pretty much. But I think that's a good length for something like this. That is the length of the gameplay between the start and the end. But I will tell you this. Normal is not an easy mode to play it in. I am going to tell you this. This game will beat the shit out of you if you're not careful.
Well, I'll probably pick it up when it price drops.
Mm-hmm.
But I will play it on normal just for that. Yeah. You know how I am.
Now, here's...
You know...
So I've glossed over and really, like, kind of spooched over, like, the storyline and stuff like that. Now, the gameplay. They introduce a cover system for Max Payne. Now, you're probably...
Okay, I've heard mixed things about this cover system. I have a friend who did a review on this game, and he didn't like the cover system.
Is he crazy? If you didn't have the freaking cover system, you'd be dead. You know how many bullets it would take Max Payne compared to any other action movie character or action game character to die?
But he didn't like in that sense. He didn't feel it was like as good as other cover systems as other games.
Well, the thing is, it's not trying to be. And the reason why is because you also have the shot dodging and the bullet time. You're supposed to use it in conjunction with those tools. And I think that the bullet time in conjunction with the cover system is perfect for this game. Because they really want you to move from cover to cover. They really want you to be super aggressive with the game. I mean, dude, when they teach you how to... Okay, when you clear a room full of enemies, the last shot is basically... You know, basically like slow motioned, like you follow the bullet from Max hitting the last bad guy that you're aiming at, and you see the impact on his body. Not only that, you can spray bullets at him as the impact progresses, literally to the point where you're literally exploding his face.
Jesus
Christ. You can't even tell what the fuck he looks like. That's how brutal this game is. It's more brutal than Mortal Kombat in a lot of cases. No dismemberment, but you can clearly, like, shoot the face off of a guy.
Jesus Christ.
It is insane. That's how brutal this game is, and that's how aggressive this game is. And that's how, you know, that's how Max feels a lot of the time. Just, you know, just total brutality and stuff. And that's the thing. It's like, even, and that's one thing. Even if you haven't played the first and the second game, it is okay. Because this is a new part of Max's life, and they've already addressed the fact why he feels like this. You know, like he has his wife that he failed to save. He has femme fatales that, you know, he didn't want to kind of associate himself with. It's just that kind of, even though it's no longer a noir storyline, it is still Max Payne through and through. Those elements are what helps define Max Payne, not exactly what defines him as an individual. And now he's just really pissed off. And the thing is, I have a friend who...
Oh, sorry.
Before I let you jump in, my friend, I actually, you know, came over when I got Max Payne 3. And he actually refused to use the cover system. You know what happened? He died plenty of times. It took the enemies 4 or 5 shots, actually less than that, 4 or 3 shots to kill him on normal. He didn't even use shot dodging. He didn't even use bullet time. He tried to play it as a regular third person shooter, as if he was playing Max Payne 1 and 2. I'm sorry. And you know what happened? Dead.
So you have to learn a little different skill set then.
Yes, these are not enemies that are poor aims. They will kill you. They will kill you from the onset. This is, like, I would probably compare it even to, you know, Ghost Recon in a way, in terms of how strong, how resilient your character is, because they're not really that resilient. Like, Max Payne is frail. He's older. He's actually a little bit chunkier, too, in some ways. And he can't take that many bullets anymore. So if you basically just run into a room, like Call of Duty style, and try to spray, like, a whole bunch of bullets to everybody, guess what's going to happen? You'll be like a pool of blood on the ground. Or you'd basically, you know, wind up using all your painkillers, because yes, you still have to use painkillers, and completely use them all up, and you haven't even gone through like a quarter of the level.
Wow.
Yeah. One thing that the game does that's interesting is when you die, you actually have a small chance to kill your assailant. Once that happens, you have a set of painkillers in your inventory, he will automatically use that painkiller to save you from dying. However, if you do not have painkillers at the end of your life, you automatically die.
Interesting.
Yep. It is brutal. It is unforgiving. It is, like, literally, like, you would, like, if you played this on hard and you tried to play this like a Call of Duty game, you will throw your controller at your TV.
So I take it you're going to beat this game.
Yes.
Okay. So With that said, well, I have to ask you, because, you know, we saw what happened with Downpour.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a whole different story. But I will say this, and I will ask you this, I should say, not say, per se. The thing is about this game is it's not that I'm not hating on it. I just don't, you know, I'm going to wait to pick it up personally.
Mm-hmm.
I will say is there's got to be some sort of flaw in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with the way you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have not said a single flaw to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a flaw in this game? Or is this the game where Alex doesn't find a flaw in it?
It's one of those games where Rockstar shows why they exist in this industry. And this further cements the idea that they are a AAA, you know, like, developer. Now, with that said, some of the level design is kind of weird. Like, there's a level where you're, like, in a stadium, and there's, like, bleachers, like, you know, like, like all over you, and you have no cover. Like, you literally can't do cover. And that one was kind of tricky to me. So, the level design is...
some mucky level design, then.
Some mucky level design kind of plagues it and stuff. But the thing is, it's probably me just not getting used to the... just the kind of gameplay system that it has. Because again, you are expected to use the cover system and bullet time and shot dodging to its strengths, like to its maximum. And you know, I'm still, even though I'm in chapter 3 and chapter 4, like I am still kind of trying to get a grips of when to use it in certain cases. But yeah, there will be times where Max Payne will face about 15 people in a room and you only have like this one pillar as cover and you're trying to figure out how the hell am I going to like kill all these fools? Cause they're now throwing grenades at me and I have no idea how to, you know, and I think that's it in a way. The way that I see it, it's a combination of like kind of like a puzzle game in a way. And I like cerebral things, let's put it that way. And kind of, you know, the traditional shooter system. With that said, they have 3 different options for aiming. They have hard targeting, soft targeting, and free targeting. Free targeting is exactly how Max Payne 1 and 2 is. Soft targeting is, I think I want to say, is very similar to Call of Duty, where if you hit the left bumper, it automatically aims at the nearest opponent near your reticle. And the hard targeting, but of course with the soft targeting, it doesn't follow, you know, the enemy. In hard targeting, I think that's more like Grand Theft Auto, where if you hold the aim button, that the reticle will follow the enemy and stuff. So you have many options to play the game on how you can play this shooter, you know, but they don't make the game any easier. But with that said, again, you have a room, you have to clear out everybody here to advance, and you have to, and sometimes you'll have to figure that out with low ammo, mind you, and you have to like use the tools that you have, like the bullet time and all that stuff. And that kind of way of gameplay is intriguing to me. But like I said, some of the level design is a little kind of weird. But I think I want to say it's only the stadium so far, because prior to that, I didn't really have any problems.
I see.
Yeah. And there are action sequences. There is a action sequence where Max accidentally falls off this helicopter and he hangs underneath and using his one hand, mind you, he's drunk while he's doing this. He basically takes out like this rocket that's being shot at the helicopter.
Jesus.
But that's to show you how badass he is. Drunk or not, he is badass.
So it's a good game.
It is a Rockstar game.
It's a Rockstar.
Which I think, you know, has to be said, it's on a whole different level than a lot of games out there in terms of quality.
Well, we'll see. I know you probably call me a blasphemer for not
No. No, but the thing is, it's the devil is in the details. This is a game in development for 6 years, and there are moments where you can tell it's been made in 6 years. Not like other games where they push it like 6 years later and it still kind of looks the same as the first time like you've seen it.
Oh, you mean
like
Duke Nukem and Final Fantasy 13 Versus?
Sure. Like, you know, like you literally, when you, there's an action scene where Max Payne jumps off of the rooftop and there's this guy holding a hostage, and while you're sliding down the side of the rooftop, you're in bullet time and you're gonna shoot the shit out of this guy to like save that, you know, save the hostage and stuff, and you dump in the water, and when you emerge out of water, you can see all the little beads of water just going down his face and how like he's all wet and stuff. And mind you, this is all in-game shit that's happening right there, and you just, you know, and you can really feel like he was drenched in water, and he's like really fucking, you know, pissed off that this happened to him, and you know, gives his friend like the gun and grabs like the dry gun and just goes through his mission, not even missing a beat. He's like, I'm gonna go after so and so to save so and so. It's like,
sounds like a good game,
great animations, and some spotty level design from time to time, great graphics, great presentation. Haven't tried the online yet, but you know me with online.
Yeah,
so we'll
I heard
have to
the
see
online's
it.
Not but yeah, I do know about that feature though, where your stats carry over to GTA 5 or something.
Yeah, they do something with the Rockstar social group, because you can make your own clubs. No, I forgot the exact terminology, but it was on the manual when I saw it. You can kind of carry over your groups of friends, I guess, from one game to another, which is actually kind of neat. And I think, I want to say it's cross-platform, but I'm not sure.
Oh.
Because it's through the Rockstar Social Club, which is cross-platform, so.
Interesting.
You know. But anyways, yes, that is my experience with Max Payne 3. If you love action games, and kind of an action game that doesn't... That is very different from a lot of the bullet sponge, you know, action games that we've been playing the past years, few years or so. Like, go try this out. It has a good mix of action and, you know, and gameplay that, you know, makes the game really interesting. I couldn't help but think of that one John Woo game, Stranglehold, every time I play this game. But it's like, it's so much better than that.
You mean it's a good game?
Yes, it's actually a good game. You know, it makes a lot of sense in that respect.
When you say Stranglehold, I go, ew.
I know. But I got it for $5 recently, so I'm like, and that really didn't appeal to me. So I was like, but this one is really interesting. It's not, okay, I'll tell you this. It is a shooter inherently. So there's not too many deep elements to it, but don't let that kind of scare you from not getting this game, because the storyline is well told. It is a Rockstar game. It will feel like a Rockstar game. It does feel like a Rockstar game. And it's sadly enough, like, you know, like, it might be on people's back burners if they miss it, because it's truly a fantastic game. I can't wait if they ever make a follow-up to this, or even DLC, which is... I am open to it. I'm open to buying its DLC, story
it's,
DLC.
It's going to be a back burner for me, but, you know, that's because.
Yeah. But for me, though, this is my break between Xenoblade Chronicles and Dragon's Dogma, which is coming out this week, brother.
Yeah, it's Ghost Recon for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ghost Recon, and you're getting Dragon's Dogma. And
yeah, I still have to make my character in Dragon's Dogma. So, but yeah, that will be the next game that I'll be getting. And I'm hoping to finish Max Payne 3 within the next few days. I literally won't open Dragon's Dogma until I finish Max Payne 3, because I think it's that important to play.
Well, hopefully I'll be able to play more Tales, and we can, I just haven't had time to play much.
Oh, geez.
So,
okay.
So, I mean, I looked at Hyper Dimension, Neptunia. So,
yeah,
we release these on Mondays.
Yeah.
So when you're listening to this, if you download it on Monday,
mm-hmm.
just remember that will be May 21st,
yeah,
2012,
mm-hmm.
which is exactly 2 weeks before E3 kicks off.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. We have a lot to talk about in E3 time. I'm just saying.
I know.
I have to stress to our audience. You know, I've said many things about this year. I've said it's the revival of JRPG, which I still really believe. You know, the first half was the year of the RPG.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stress the other thing again. And you know what that is?
What?
E3 is going to be more interesting than it has in the last several years this year.
Absolutely. I totally agree with this. And just to kind of stress, too, usually record these episodes on the weekends, and then we release it on Mondays. Next week, we are actually changing the recording schedule. And we're letting you guys know this because if you guys want to write to us and stuff, we want to make sure that we get everything for the next episode. The next episode is actually going to be released 2 days after this is released. So this might not be enough time for you to kind of like catch up with us, but rest assured that, you know, we will read your emails as always and stuff. And we will be recording these episodes on Wednesday starting this week, actually, when you guys hear this. So again, email us at partychat@gamerhorizon.com once you do have any questions and whatnot. So, and, you know, E3 related stuff, like what we think is going to be like the most, you know, the biggest surprises of E3. Because I don't know if you've seen this, Anthony, but, you know, Kojima has been releasing these torture porn kind of videos online to tease, I guess, Rising?
Yeah, maybe. There's this big thing going on with Kojima right now, mm-hmm. apparently. There's some sort of super announcement. Like, I mean, this is major big. And when Kojima says it's big, it's big. A big announcement at E3.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the most confirmed thing that we know is it's Kojima's next directed game, whatever that is, whether it's a Metal Gear Solid 5 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I know we'll hear more about Revengeance and stuff,
yeah,
which is actually being developed by Platinum, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Not Kojima Studios.
Yeah,
so this will be a Kojima, this next announcement. And I think a lot of this goes into what's going on is, you know, Revengeance, Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, which got revamped.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason they got revamped and sent to Platinum was because they're working on whatever is going to be announced at E3.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be a big announcement.
Yeah, this is not going to be a small thing. This is, Kojima has been building this engine for the next gen for years.
The Fox engine, correct?
Uh-huh. And yeah, it's multi-platform. We know that much.
So we don't know what this game is. I mean, most people are assuming, and it may be right, it is Metal Gear Solid 5. But I don't really know. And to be honest, I don't know what else they could do with Metal Gear.
Yeah. But if you have any speculation as to what any of the companies are doing, send us an email, partychat@gamerhorizon.com, because we are interested in, you know, seeing what you guys are interested in, you know, for E3. And we will read it, you know, in our E3 specific episode or the next one, depending on like what kind of email you have for us.
Could I actually make a plug for something, a plan that you probably know? I know we don't talk about this type of stuff usually, but it's important. As you know, I have a YouTube channel. I'm not talking about this usually, but I'm going to do a panel with two of my friends, including and two of my other friends and Alex on E3. So we'll have a little bit of a kind of a group discussion on that, too. That'll tie into the podcast.
Yeah.
Usually we don't do things like that, but I think it's cool. I think E3 panel discussions are fun to do, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because E3 can be such a heated topic.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's E3.
And we have to do a separate E3 thing too, I think.
Yeah, we'll do our separate E3 thing.
Yeah, because I think that'll be kind of interesting to talk about too. So, but anyways, I think it's time to talk about the news that has happened the past week or so.
Yay.
You should be like more excited about that, because this determines the future of the video game industry.
Yay. Well, you know, the news has been weird lately. It's been kind of depressing.
Yes and no. Yes and no. But let me go ahead and start with some really good news, you know, and this is, again, our newslog segment. Welcome. Square Enix sees 6 billion yen profit in fiscal 2012 thanks to Deus Ex and Final Fantasy 13 2. You're probably happy about that.
Yeah, both good games.
I'll say one of them is. Total income from sales for the fiscal year, which for Square Enix ran from April 2011 to March 2012, totaled up to $127.89 billion, or $1.6 billion, or actually it's 129.89 billion yen, or $1.6 billion, a 2.1% year-over increase. After subtracting taxes and operating costs, the company was left over 6 billion in profit, which must be welcome news for stockholders still feeling the sting from Square Enix's 12.04 billion or $150 million loss in fiscal 2011. So they actually earned money last year. Square? Incredible.
Well, what is it doing right? Well, let's talk about that real quick. People bash on Square Enix a lot, right?
They have been over the past few years. I think it's just, yeah. I think that has something to do with just with the Final Fantasy brand kind of becoming almost second fiddle to the Dragon Quest series. Because that, well, you know,
it's more than that. It's Square. When you say Square Enix, let's look at this for, and this is going to be a little ridiculous, but it's the truth. You look at Square Enix, okay? You know what catches your eye? Not the Enix, it's the Square.
Mm-hmm.
It's Square, because you know what Square is known for.
Right.
Okay. This company is not the same company it was 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
15 years ago, 10 years ago. Okay, this was a company known for the Japanese role-playing game, but it's a company that has evolved. And the best move that it has ever done was buy fucking Eidos.
Yep.
Because what happened here was this is the good of Square, okay? This is what Square has done. They bought fucking Eidos, and when they bought Eidos, they turned a company that was, and I'm going to probably get bashed for this, a company that has been putting out mediocre stuff, for some time. Mm-hmm. And they have somehow revamped that company into somebody that is just quality. Something that they make good games, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, look at... what was that one game? It was a sequel to a shitty open world game. Just Cause 2. Mm-hmm. Just Cause 2 was such an improvement over the Eidos original. That's one example. Then you have what is truly the crowning achievement, Deus Ex.
Human Revolution.
You know, Human Revolution. Not the original, but Deus Ex Human Revolution. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that company is just in a shift now. Like, and it's so weird because they were getting accused of making mediocre games for a while, which I guess is true to some degree. Okay. But then they took this company that was making mediocre games and kind of gave them a boost. They even got me, who are not interested in franchises such as Tomb Raider, interested in it. So I think Eidos is a big factor in this.
Yeah, Eidos is basically Square Enix putting a foot in the Western market, like really and firmly planting it in there. It's basically their commitment to earn a profit from that region, because I think they've tried over the past few years to do that with their franchises and just kind of realized that, you know, the JRPG market, as they have come to understand it, is probably not something that they understand fully in the U.S. market. And I think that what they're doing is they're learning a lot about the market here by actually releasing a lot of Eidos' titles. And Eidos has a great selection of brands. They have Tomb Raider, they have Hitman, Kane and Lynch, well, you know, it's hit or miss.
Kane and Lynch.
You know, there's Just Cause, there's, you know, let's not forget Fear Effect back in, you know, the PlayStation era.
Ah, Fear Effect was so good.
You know, and they have so much in that, you know. And they have Thief, they have Deus Ex, and the next project.
Don't they have, who has Soul Reaver?
They have it. Eidos has that. Eidos has the entire Legacy of Kain series.
Imagine what they could do with that now. Holy shit.
Yeah. It's really rather interesting to kind of see where they would take the rest of the franchises. I know for a fact that the Deus Ex Human Revolution guys, Eidos Montreal, they are currently developing a sequel to Thief, and I am really excited for that, because before even Skyrim was ever even a possibility, before Oblivion and before, you know, Morrowind and stuff, we had Thief, which is the original, like, medieval stealth action game. And that is just gonna be fucking incredible. You have, like, water arrows and stuff that could, like, you know, just extinguish, like, you know, torches, you know, to basically increase, you know, the darkness in the area. I mean, Thief is one of those games that is just absolutely, like, you know, needs a current gen rendition. And the fact that the Deus Ex guys are doing it, sign me up, because I am right there through and through. And Crystal Dynamics just recently hired Corey Barlog. In case you guys don't know who that guy is, he was the guy responsible for God of War 2. And he is going to help Crystal Dynamics shape Tomb Raider for next year. And that is just pretty fantastic in my book.
This is such a revival. And then, of course, how the Square themselves factor into this, right?
Yeah, basically for all the promotional stuff that Eidos is actually putting out, they are all rendered in Square Enix server farms. They are all being done with CG, you know, in Square Enix. So the
Final Fantasy 13 style.
Same guys who do the Final Fantasy CG cutscenes, those guys are doing the promotional shit and the CG stuff in those games.
So they've got a powerful resource. So Square Enix is obviously on the up and go, right?
Yeah.
With this. But what does it need to do? Well, there's a couple things it needs to do still, I think. There's still some work. Square Enix, I've always been somewhat of a defender. They've made mistakes the last few years, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think now they're starting to make good choices, which a lot of Japanese companies do. As much as I defend Japanese games, I will acknowledge that you have valid points in that market, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we even talked about Hyper Dynamic mentioned Neptunia, which is self-aware of that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So Square Enix is going in the right direction. However, there are still things to fix, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, it's trademark franchise, the Final Fantasy series.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, I like 13-2. I think 13-2, in terms of gameplay, I know you may disagree, is the right direction going back to what that franchise is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You may disagree with that. However, there are still several issues need to be resolved, particularly Final Fantasy 14, which apparently they are working on.
Yeah.
But I really don't care about that, to be quite frank with you. Mm-hmm. And Final Fantasy 14 version 2.0?
Yeah, that, and they still have 11 up too. So they're running two MMOs concurrently.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're from what I understand, 14 2.0 is a complete restructure.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. If you're skeptical of it, I can't blame you, cuz from what I've heard, that's a horrible game.
Yeah.
But then again, you have the disappointment with Final Fantasy 13. And then, of course, you have the infamous Versus 13, which I will not get you started on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they need, if they're going in the right direction with Eidos, what they need to do is learn some things from Eidos. This is my hope. It goes both ways. It's not just Eidos utilizing Square's resources and improving themselves. Square's own internal development should learn things from Eidos as well.
Mm-hmm.
That may not happen because of the traditionalistic ideal, but I could see it happening with the changes they're making as is.
Mm-hmm.
So what does Square need to do? First of all, as much as great as those Eidos brands are, they still need to focus on their own brands, mm-hmm. other than Dragon Quest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and Final Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to bring Final Fantasy. Again, I said this last week, there's a rumored Final Fantasy 15 may show up. Who knows what the hell is going to happen with that? Mm-hmm. That's speculation.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to revitalize Final Fantasy, and they also need to somehow modernize some of their older franchises.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, there's still a strong fan base for that.
I mean,
so
that's what they're doing with Eidos. Might as well do it for their own franchises, too, you know?
Exactly. I mean, it's not just Final Fantasy. What other franchises do you have?
You have Brainfencer Musashi, you have Bushido Blade, Parasite Eve, we saw that, but you know what happened there. Kingdom Hearts has been stagnant in the main consoles for a long time. Haven't
right.
seen anything on that. There's, you know, the other, there's Type Zero, which needs to come over here. You can go on and on and on. I mean, there's
Rono.
Yeah, and if you want to say to a lesser degree, the Bouncer.
Oh shit!
The Chocobo Racing series, the Chocobo Dungeon series.
Well, now we're getting. I'm talking about good. They're good stuff. Let's,
Tom Sawyer for the NES.
Oh shit! Rad Racer.
Yeah, Rad Racer.
No, as big as a fan as I am of Square games, they even back then they produced some shits.
Mm-hmm.
They Chocobo Racing and stuff. But I want to see a revitalization of their own brands, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Chrono. Like, imagine what you could do Chrono if you add a little bit of that Western flair with it, but mm-hmm. still keep it inherently a Japanese-style story.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Well,
imagine what you could do with that.
Well, here's the thing with me right now. I think that last story, which is not a Square Enix title, of course, will have some interesting things to show us once it finally is out next month. And the reason why I say this is because they are doing things that are very different than most JRPGs. I mean, for crying out loud, it has a multiplayer mode. Like a straight-up deathmatch mode or something like that.
It shows Sakaguchi still understands the market.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of glowing reviews about that everywhere else. So we're going to see if that truly is kind of like a demonstration of an RPG legend's understanding of what needs to happen in JRPGs in order to advance, or it could just flub like everything else. I think it'll be interesting to see what he does, and it'll be interesting to see if people follow suit.
Let's put it this way. A lot of things you got to understand about Sakaguchi, too, is about the last story in particular, my friend, is, and I know you know this for a fact, is what I think is more fascinating other than the game itself about Last Story is Sakaguchi, with all the Mistwalker games and all Final Fantasies post Final Fantasy V, he's been kind of the idea guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he feeds the ideas and then someone else directs it and all that.
Yeah.
He has not directed a game since actually directed a game since Final Fantasy V.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what. So obviously, with the glowing reviews and stuff, this is a guy who have been kind of more of an idea guy,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily directing something. And he directs this game that has gotten glowing reviews in both Japan and Europe. Mm-hmm. And if that's any indication, your Europe's taste is very similar to what we have here. Mm-hmm. In some
probably more critical too.
Yeah, they're. I mean, if you look at European magazines, particularly Edge and stuff, they are extremely. They're harsher than even Famitsu, which used to be considered the hardest,
mm-hmm.
harshest magazine. They're worse than Famitsu in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he still got it.
Yeah.
Oh, and before we transition, we want to talk about Tomb Raider real quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tomb Raider basically gets pushed to first quarter 2013. Now, again, kind of like going along the lines of when Bioshock Infinite got pushed the next year, I am actually super happy that this got pushed to 2013 because this will allow me to have ample time to play through all the games that are coming out. And I am really excited about that. The fact that I'll have time to play Assassin's Creed 3, Black Ops 2, of course, I'm skipping Halo 4, Last of Us. I mean, those are just a few games that I'm looking forward to in a fall. And by them pushing Tomb Raider, that means I will have ample time to actually play through Lara Croft's latest adventure, you know, in a time frame that is outside of the holidays. And I am completely okay with that.
And more time to, you know, once you beat those other shorter games, you can go to Persona 4.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. So, about, you know what, 2013, early 2013, so far is not looking bad.
Well, we have Bioshock Infinite and that.
And Ni No Kuni.
Yeah, Ni No Kuni also. Holy crap.
So far, three good solid titles for the...
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, I remember in a previous episode, you were kind of worried about... You know, next year, because you were like, oh man, maybe they're gonna release new consoles next year because they haven't announced anything for next year. But then of course these three got pushed, and now you're like, we're both like, oh, that is a perfect time frame for that.
Oh shit, yeah. Well, but still, if you look at the outset, it's still a little bit more barren. But I'm sure E3 will change all that. So.
Oh yeah, people are gonna start pushing things back to the first quarter. The first quarter is the new holiday season.
Yeah,
or an extension of that is like literally September all the way to like March of next year is the new holiday season.
You know what it is? It's September. Sometimes even August. I would say August to a degree in some cases.
Some cases, yeah.
Yeah, some cases. August to November. Then there's a break in December and maybe a little bit of a break in January. Sometimes January is as unstable as August.
Mm-hmm.
And then you blow up again in February.
Yeah.
Because February you always blow up.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
So it's gonna be a very interesting year. And I think even, you know, it's February to what, May even? In mm-hmm. some cases, so it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. I expect a lot of pushbacks.
Again, E3 going to be really exciting.
Yay!
Yeah.
Speaking,
we
of
haven't stuff, had we haven't had an E3 this exciting in years.
I know. It's. I mean, I think the big thing everyone's going to talk about is Wii U. Obviously,
yeah.
I'm interested in seeing the launch lineup. That's my big thing.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the next article. Remember when we were talking about Itagaki last week, or actually two episodes ago with Richard from Operation Rainfall?
Yes, sir.
Well, apparently, his Devil's Third game is seeking a new publisher. Yay! Wait, is that supposed to be a yay? It's a yay for me, maybe. THQ has stated that they are ditching the Devil's Third project and are currently trying to pawn it off to another publisher. So this is exactly what happened.
Tecmo.
Oh, gosh. That would be hilarious if, like, Itagaki's trying to get away from, like, Koei Tecmo and they wind up buying the game. How ironic is that?
That would be the biggest fucking irony.
Yeah.
And then you have Valhalla and Team Ninja.
Yeah, it's like, what? They're both trying to finish the game, you know? It's like, what? What the hell? Weird shit. Anyways, this is what Brian Farrell, the THQ president, had to say about, you know, the whole thing. Two unforeseen events reduced Devil's Third's profitability. First of all, the company Valhalla that, well, the company Valhalla was using for the engine went out of business. Dun, dun, dun. So we had to assist Itagaki-san and a team to make, mind you, get this, a brand new engine from scratch. It took a fair amount of time and cost a fair amount of money. There has also been a substantial appreciation of the yen against the dollar. So what that basically means is the company that they were using for the engine went out of business, so they had to build an engine straight up from scratch. That is a huge time and money investment right there.
Oh, it's becoming vaporware. Bye-bye.
Oh, jeez, yeah. So, yeah, but I am with you on this. That would be hilarious if Koei Tecmo bought it. And I would
Do you think they would buy it? Do you really think?
Maybe.
But it would be hilarious.
I have a feeling they might, but I'm not sure. THQ is the one actually selling off the project, because obviously they have some investments in it, and they want to kind of recoup it. They don't just want to, like, hand it off to somebody. So we'll see. We'll see who does it. If it's Square Enix, I wouldn't be too surprised, actually.
I would even go further and say maybe even EA.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well,
I wouldn't want EA to get it, because the EA Partners Program has been a flop to everybody who's been in the Partners Program so far.
But I thought you're not a big fan of Itagaki.
I'm not a big fan of Itagaki, but that doesn't mean that, you know, that I wish, like, his projects would fail every single time. Right. I do want to at least see the game out, and that is more important to me than actually seeing him fail.
Okay, well, that's
the most important thing for me, for anybody. Like, I may, like, dog on a game and stuff, but that doesn't mean that I don't feel for, like, any other people who are fans of his games. Like, I don't wish failure on anybody. I'm critical of games, but I would like everybody to be able to release their games, because every game that's released in the market right now affects the industry in some form or fashion.
Right.
You know.
Well, who knows what's going to happen to it, so.
No kidding. But the next one is good news, THQ-wise. The entire Saints Row franchise ships 11 million units. And of course, they just confirmed that Saints Row the third standalone expansion is due in September. For the record, Saints Row the third sells 4.25 million units. And they're saying the game has generated the highest digital revenue of any console title in THQ's history.
That's a fun game.
It's still one of my favorites. Like I said, I played through Gangsters in Space, the expansion. Really fun expansion. Like, I can't wait for the standalone expansion. And it's funny because, like, I didn't pick up the standalone expansions for Grand Theft Auto 4, but I am picking up Saints Row the Third, like, standalone expansion. You know?
Saints Row's one of those series, like Assassin's Creed, where I hated the original game.
Yeah, I did not like 1 or 2. And they gave 2 for free. You know,
but with the PS3 version. But a work of genius.
Yeah. That is basically them throwing out everything out the window and saying, let's make a brand new engine. Let's make this the most badass and awesome franchise ever. And it's almost kind of like a series reboot in a way, you know? And I am okay with that. And I am completely okay with that reboot.
Yeah, it's a fun game. It's, you know what? It doesn't try to take itself seriously.
That is what we need more of in this industry.
You know, it's just, I like serious games, but there's some games that, you know, it'll have, like Skyrim comes to mind, where it takes itself so seriously, mm-hmm. but there's just goofy stuff in it.
Mind you, it takes itself so seriously to the point of, like, reviewers on their podcasts talking about how they're not looking forward to the first expansion.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, because they've been Skyrimmed out.
Yeah, too many arrows in the knees. I mean, come on, man.
I know.
I know that joke's been old, but I mean, just even placing that in the game.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you trying to add character to guards who? How many? Never mind. Anyway,
yeah. Let us not get into that.
Yeah, it's still mind-boggling, and people still use that joke.
But yeah, Saints Row, great title. Glad for their success. I hope that somehow they, you know, pull a profit. Really looking forward to whatever they have in store for the standalone expansion, the Enter the Dominatrix expansion.
Nice.
So, next one. So, last week, remember, or was it 2 weeks ago, remember when we talked about the possibilities as to why a Street Fighter Cross Tekken didn't sell?
Yeah.
Well, Capcom actually addressed that recently. They said that they actually think that they... Get this. This is one of the funniest realizations and kind of statements I've ever seen. But it's... But Capcom basically said they released too many fighting games.
You know, that's true.
I know, but it's kind of like them, you know, like, it's kind of like, no, duh. Like, what have you been releasing that's, you know, the past few years, if you think about it, other than, you know, the main titles, you know? It's like, look at what you did, like, Marvel vs. Capcom 3 last year. You really lost consumer confidence in that game.
You just... Let's... Capcom has always been infamous for this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but... Here's the thing, you can't get away with it like you used to.
No, not back in the cartridge days and stuff where everything is relatively cheaper than what it is now. I mean,
or no, you want to go further than that? The arcade market.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, back then that was a back when they started, you know, when they started releasing other editions of Street Fighter. Mm-hmm. There was this whole other, you know, you had PC gaming back then, you had console gaming, you had handheld, but you also forget you also had a third type of gaming, and that a fourth type, and that was arcade.
Right.
And you don't have it in the degree that, I guess you kind of have it, but not necessarily. Mm-hmm. But remember back then, we lived in a day and age where, you know, it was kind of like, and I always equivalent to when you have a movie in the movie theater, and you wait for the, you know, VHS release. Yeah. You had a game in the arcade, and it was kind of a big deal, mm-hmm, for it to come to the home port. It was the blockbuster type of,
yeah,
thing. And back then, they could get away with that, and now it's a different market because you have ways to avoid re-releasing different versions. You have downloadable content.
Absolutely.
And stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you wanted to release Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3, you should have at least released it as an upgrade.
But not within the same fucking year you released the original game.
Well, no. The way they should have done it is as some sort of downloadable content.
Yeah.
But of course, I know there's fixes and tweaks and stuff like that, but still.
It's just poor decision-making on their part. Like, they shouldn't have released two Marvel vs. Capcom 3 games within the same calendar year. I mean, that's basically what happened. They released, you know, in the spring, they released MVC3, and in the fall, we saw another MVC3, which is why no one wants to buy part, you know, like Street Fighter Cross Tekken, because guess what? They don't know if they're going to release a brand new one this fall.
Oh, no, well, remember the Vita version debacle as well.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to be talking about next. Capcom is actually reevaluating on-disc DLC. So, the senior vice president of the company in the United States, Christian Svensson, said, "We would like to assure you that we have been listening to your comments as such and have begun a process of reevaluating how such additional game content is delivered in the future. Capcom decided to add DLC on Dragon's Dogma disc at the beginning of the game's development cycle. So, at this time, this was determined by, you know, to be the most efficient way of ensuring certain content was made available, but as Svensson concludes, you've been heard." So it's funny that they basically said that, oh yeah, by the way, Dragon's Dogma still has this, even though they're reevaluating this, you know. And they planned it on the very beginning, which is kind of surprising because, you know, I've been told usually those are last minute shit.
Well, let's be fair here. Capcom's not the only one guilty of this.
Yep.
So, but if they're reevaluating it, because Capcom is still a major player in the game industry, mm-hmm, it's probably the biggest, I think, of the Japanese companies.
Yeah.
And I think, in all honesty, Capcom's up there. I think if you look at it, you know, you have the big companies, Activision's, EA's, whatever, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
You can add, I think it's safe to say, and to some degree, out of the two main Japanese companies, well, Nintendo up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean third-party developers. Capcom and Square Enix, I would say, mm-hmm, would be the two biggest ones. Capcom the biggest, though.
Mm-hmm.
And if they start reevaluating it, maybe some other publishers will do the same.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big maybe.
Yeah, the thing is, I'm wondering what that means when it comes to downloading stuff. Because the thing is that's, that people don't understand here in the United States is that pretty soon our internet is going to be metered. What does that mean? That means every megabyte that we download will come with a cost.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of companies that are starting to roll that out right now. My AT&T actually has a 250 gigabyte limit. If I go over that, I pay an additional fee a month. Okay?
Right.
Now, what they've as I've mentioned before, one of the reasons why they do on this DLC is not just for compatibility, but ensuring the fact that when they do finally release the complete product, you only have to download maybe balancing stuff or, you know, or some assets in order to activate it, you know, like some very small file. What that will mean is we're gonna be forced to actually purchase more and more hard drives over time because, you know, like we have 250 gigabyte, you know, like storage and stuff for some of our stuff. Like the PS3, I mean, you can pop in a terabyte hard drive there, no problem. But are you really going to buy like an overpriced $300, you know, 100 gigabyte, whatever, you know, big Xbox 360 hard drive is going to be like when they demand like you download 2 gigabytes worth of like a downloadable content? I don't think so.
Right, right.
You know, Microsoft is already experimenting with this with their on-demand stuff, which is great. Like, they're only like 4 gigabytes, whatever, you know? But imagine if DLC has to be that big, too.
Yeah.
That's gonna be an interesting thing to talk about. Like, right now, a lot of the DLC is about kilobytes, which is very tiny, which means a lot of the stuff is already on the disk. Great. You don't have to buy a new hard drive. But when storage becomes a problem again, I want to see those same people who complain about on this DLC complain up, you know, I'm pretty sure they're going to start complaining about the cost of like storage, and it's just never going to end.
You're never going to please gamers. That's a fact.
That's the thing, right? I mean, you know, like, there are people who basically are against this and stuff, like who are also, you know, like colleagues in the press. But I think that people need to kind of figure out what that means by having the on-disk DLC not be on disk. The terminology is stupid anyway. Like, I would agree with that. Downloadable content, but it's on disk. That's not downloadable content. It's a fucking key. Okay?
Yeah.
And even games are becoming downloadable too. So it's kind of like, it's kind of weird to say, well, this downloadable game has on-disk DLC, but it's not on a disk. It's like, what? You know, I think standards need to change, and it's the landscape of the gaming industry in this generation has changed so much that we need to kind of sit down and be like, all right, well, what is this really, you know, and kind of go from there.
Right.
You know, so anyways, so I'm going to skip the talk about, you know, Treyarch talking about their visuals. Basically, like, they started talking about, like, oh, the engine doesn't really dictate the quality of the visuals. Mind you, the newer Call of Duty games, they all stem from this little game back in that was released back in 1999 called Quake 3.
Oh, yay!
Yeah, all Call of Duties are based off of that. Let's not kid ourselves. But you'd be hard-pressed to see, like, a game engine running at 60 frames per second looking as good as the Call of Duties. And it's because of the way that Quake 3 actually handles those levels. Heck, right. Even Rage has difficult times staying at a high frame rate, you know? But I want to talk about this next one. Walking Dead sells 1 million copies. This is a record for Telltale Games.
Yay!
That sounded like a forced yay.
No, that's a good thing.
Yeah. So what do you think about this?
That's good news. Just all I care about is episode 2 coming out.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So that's all we have to say about that. Congratulations to Telltale for 1 million copies. We want swag. Anyways. okay, this is kind of bad. So 38 Studios apparently had took out a $75 million loan from the state of Rhode Island, and they're the guys responsible for Kingdoms of Amalur. And now here's the thing. It's a lot of things have happened over the past few days. 38 Studios paid off the installment payment of $1.125 million to the state, but they missed their payment to their employees.
Oh,
this week, no one got paid. What do you think about this, though? I mean, this means to what this means to me. Mind you, Amalur sold 400,000 units, which is respectable. I see a company biting off more than they can chew. What do you think?
Yeah, it seems that way. They're not as big as they could be. They don't have the pull of other Western RPG developers.
I mean, remember that they've been working on an MMORPG for years.
And MMOs are expensive to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
This is not good. I don't know if they can survive this. I may be jumping the gun, but still.
Yeah. Rhode Island is no longer giving them any funds. They basically said that they are releasing Project Copernicus, which is basically the Amalur game for next year, to be released in June 2013. And to be honest, I don't like to see them go, because I want to see a Kingdoms of Amalur Reckoning 2, but that might be their fate, sadly.
And then it says it will not. There's a big decision that's coming Monday.
Yeah. So when this gets released, there's a big decision coming up on that.
And we'll talk about it next episode.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah. Well, good luck to everybody at 38 Studios. Hopefully, you guys, you know, are still employed and stuff. I mean, there's 379 people there as of March. Hopefully, they all can still keep their jobs and stuff. We don't know how the expansions are doing either, but I can tell you that I haven't purchased any of them just because, you know, so many games coming out. So,
right.
Anyways, next topic. Various issues plague Diablo 3 launch. So, among the issues being reported by players, an inability to start up global matchmaking, decryption errors related to corrupt installation files, and of course, the pernicious Error 37, which indicates a full server. Blizzard has posted a list of some of the errors on their forums, and you might want to check it out. And if you're one of the affected gamers, you know, check it out. So, have you ever heard of you being unable to play a single player game because the server you're connecting to is full?
No.
This is fucking ridiculous.
No, I have never heard of this, and this is the most... Let me tell you, you know what day and age I come from?
What?
I'm an old-timer, okay? You're an old-timer.
Yeah.
I come from the fucking days, and in some ways, I miss this, okay? Mm-hmm. Sure, you can watch your Netflix, and you could go to your PlayStation stores or your Xbox Marketplace. That stuff is all nice, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we ultimately get on these machines to play games.
Yeah.
When you turn on your NES without any fucking game, there's a flashing screen.
Flashing gray screen, yeah.
Yeah, a flashing gray screen. Nintendo NES had no internet connections, no anything like that. Mm-hmm. You pop in fucking Contra and you're fucking playing Contra, and that's what the NES's sole destiny is, to fucking play Contra, okay? That's what you're meant to do. Okay, you don't need to connect to no Nintendo servers to play it. You don't need to go through any any menus or anything. You just play motherfucking Contra.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. I never thought that you'd have to log online, play through Diablo 3 single player campaign and not be, "Oh, you can't play it. You can't play it even though you bought the game."
Mm-hmm.
That's like you play the game and then it's like, fuck you, you can't play it because other people are playing the game even though we're playing it single player. Fuck you. You didn't come in fast enough. That's bullshit.
So the way that I saw this is that because they're actually going to allow real money trading on this, it's a way for them to kind of maintain and kind of monitor save games online. And and that's really the only way that they can do it, is that there's like minute to minute syncing of all your character's information and stuff. Not necessarily progress through the game, but, you know, basically like how your items are and stuff. And just to make sure that you're not kind of using, you know, hacking tools and kind of giving yourself a billion gold and all that stuff, which is, you know, like kind of reasonable, I would say. But the fact of the matter is, I don't like the idea of not being able to play the game offline, because I'm not going to be, connected to the internet all the time. You know, like I can, you know, like let's say I'm like at a, you know, Like, let's say I am in, I don't know, like, a place where it doesn't have internet. Like, I'm on a plane that, you know, the internet is too expensive. I'm not going to want to, like, you know, pay, I don't know, like, $80, like, for each, like, you know, connecting flight or whatever just to play, like, Diablo. You know, like, I want to be able to play it, like, offline, and I want to be able to play it on my terms. You know, and yes, you know, there's some sort of inherent kind of, like, entitlement to this. But when we want to play games, you know, like, we are moving towards a point in time where we want to play games on whatever device that we want, whenever we want. That is why mobile gaming is so prevalent. That's why even Facebook gaming is so prevalent. That's why portable gaming is higher than it's ever been, you know. And the fact that you are going the opposite route in this particular game is kind of like a slap in the face for a lot of people, even though their reasons are sound.
You know what I should do just to fucking be an ass?
What?
Buy my old PlayStation 1 version of Diablo 1 and play it.
Oh, jeez.
Because at least that version, it may be the first game, but at least I can play it without having to worry about being online.
How about Torchlight 2, which will launch for like $20?
Yeah. Is it, well, what's the DRM situation on that?
I don't know, but they've been really open as far as that game is concerned, but I can check for you. But I mean, you know, to me, like, it's like, I have a friend who actually is playing through Diablo 3 right now, and he was like basically saying, like, he even said that, you know, he wouldn't, you know, cuz he got the game pretty cheap and stuff. But I'm not going to say how, but, he basically said, like, yeah, I wouldn't pay like $60 for this.
Let's look at a company, their name, particularly CD Projekt. They run that little website called GOG, which they're, you know, they believe in what you said, play games whenever the fuck you want. And with GOG, they sell old games. You know, I have Baldur's Gate 2 here. You know, if I wanted to, I don't need to worry about no DRM bullshit. I could just get on and play the motherfucker.
But to be fair, though, Steam had problems too when it first launched. Like Half-Life 2, I was there day one on Steam, and you know, I'm shy to admit this, but I did write Gabe Newell a really scathing email about like
the
failure of, like, you know, Steam to unlock my copy of Half-Life 2. It's a good thing he didn't put a block on my
account. Well,
that
kills our chances of having him on Gamer Horizon, so.
But okay, so I mean, I can't find anything about DRM. There probably is going to be some sort of DRM, but I mean, the fact of the matter is still, you know, there's going to be LAN co-op multiplayer, which is great, online multiplayer for $20. You know, and if you really don't like Diablo 3 that much, even though it does offer a lot of really neat features, I mean, there are choices. You are not stuck with Diablo 3.
I think, too, I like the art direction of Torchlight. It's a little bit more appealing.
I'll tell you this. I do not like the opening movie because it looks like a cheap Flash animation.
Oh, well, yeah. I'm talking about the look of the game more so than...
Well, yeah, I know you're talking about the look of the game more, and I actually like that. I like the look of Torchlight 2. Diablo 3, though, still looks really good compared to Torchlight 2. But again, 60, 20. Again, people have a choice. If they think this is bullshit, hey, you know what? The Torchlight 2 guys, they have a beta. You know,
play
that.
It.
Yeah, exactly. And again, in my case, I'm not poo-pooing Diablo 3. I will get it at some point. I am RPG fatigued out. Like, I do not see any value to getting Diablo 3 right now. Especially when Dragon's Dogma is coming out, which I feel is more of my style of, you know, RPGing.
And you still have Xenoblade, and you still have fucking Last Story coming out, and you still have this and that, and Me Too.
Radiata Stories, you know, Radiant Historia, you know, it's all these things.
Yeah, you got to play that once your RPG fatigue is over.
We'll see. I mean, it's just going to continue probably. So, anyways, so our last topic, I think this is really inspiring. There's a girl named Kelly Wells that actually traveled from Maine to California and got inspired to do this because of Guild Wars.
The original.
So this is kind of like a statement from her blog. She actually blogged her entire journey. Okay, she said, "I'm tired of being scared of the world. I want an adventure, and I want others to realize that they too can have an adventure. That all you have to do is just go out there and try. You don't have to be super fit or have special equipment or have $1 million. You just have to walk out the door and throw yourself into the world."
Right.
So what's funny is, you know, she actually got to visit ArenaNet. You know, the guy is responsible for Guild Wars 2. And what's really cool is that when she got to ArenaNet in November of last year, they showed her something that we just got to see recently, which is they put her character from Guild Wars and her dog into Guild Wars 2 as main characters of the game.
Nice.
Yeah. So this is what Lindsay Murdoch, which is one of the game designers of the game, has to say. "I think that what Kelly did is one of the coolest things I've ever heard of, ever. I've always been impressed by fans who get tattoos inspired by their favorite game, but to be motivated to take an epic journey across the country on foot and with your trusty animal companion, that's magical. It's something that immediately shot up to the top of my list of reasons to be incredibly proud of being a game developer." So
that is good.
So basically, Kelly's character, her name in Guild Wars 1 is Amaranth. She'll be a Silvari, kind of like a plant-type creature. And her dog, which is kind of, you know, like a plant-like dog, Anna, will actually exist in the world of Tyria when Guild Wars 2 does come out. In fact, she exists in the beta right now. Players will be able to interact with her, you know, learning about the sense of wonder and adventure that drives her to cross continents and two different dimensions. And what do you think about this? And I'm actually going to pull up her blog just to kind of see if I have the correct URL here.
Well, it's pretty good. You know, you always hear the old argument, oh, video games are going to inspire you to kill people, you know?
Yeah.
Let's look at this. There's always and will be this sort of negative stigma that, you know, video gamers are, you know, virgin, no life fucks. And, you know, there will always be that. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a negative stigma that, you know, video games get us unhealthy and stuff, which is not necessarily true. You know, mm-hmm. I remember, and I told you this years ago, and I'm going to tell you it again. And this completely contradicts something that I saw years ago. There is a show my son used to watch. It was a horrible show on PBS Kids. It was called The Big Green Rabbit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, oh my God, there's an ish episode where the girl took the green big rabbit or whatever the fuck it was, and it comes to life. It's usually a stuffed animal. It's like a Barney-like thing. Comes to life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these kids getting excited, and then mm-hmm. there's this antagonistic kid. And mm-hmm. she's all, oh, animals suck and stuff. Guess what her favorite hobby was?
Mm-hmm.
Guess.
What?
Guess.
I don't know. I'm not going to guess
Video games.
Okay.
Video games, okay? That's why I wanted you to guess, because the answer is quite obvious.
Oh, jeez.
But it was video games.
Okay.
And she's all, I'd rather stay in and play video games than go outside.
Ew.
And I'm like, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell?
I mean, there's still jokes that exist with that kind of idea in mind, too.
Yeah, but still, this I think negates it.
Mm-hmm.
The story. I mean, it inspires someone to go outside and go across the country.
Yeah, mind you, it took her 6 months to do this. This is not a weekend job. It took her literally 6 months. She pretty much did the Oregon Trail, but she didn't wind up in Oregon.
And no pepperoni and cheese.
And no skirt and no dysentery. I mean, just saying. But if you guys want to read her amazing blog, she actually blogged the entire time. And mind you, it's kind of funny though, like not to poo-poo her, but you know, she did have a lot of provisions just to make sure she basically kind of like had a shopping cart filled with stuff. And she traveled across country, which is not bad. I mean, you do need some provisions in order to survive that trip. I'm not going to lie. Like, 6 months, that's a long freaking time to take to go from Maine to California, where it takes us literally hours to get from, like, plane, you know? But it's really encouraging and inspiring to see somebody do this, you know, and really, like, I've always considered trying to backpack throughout Europe just to see how far I can get with only, like, maybe a few dollars, like, off of my pocket. And this is definitely one of those things that even though a lot of people say, oh, you're going to get raped, you're going to get killed, you know, you're going to get taken advantage of, she never encountered any of that. Which proves, you know, despite the pessimism of a lot of people that she encounters, and everybody's pessimism, including on the internet, there is some good left in people. And yeah. She met all of them. You know, which is great. So her blog, which actually chronicles her entire adventure, is Amaranth, A-M as in Mary, E-R-A-N as in never, T-H, .wordpress.com. Again, that's Amaranth, A-M as in Mary, E-R-A-N as in never, T-H, .wordpress.com. She actually outlines her entire journey, and it's really awesome to, you know, to be able to kind of say, like, hey, you know, like, I went on this adventure, and it's really great, you know?
Yeah.
And it's pretty fantastic that she did it. It's a great feeling to be able to finish that, too. And, of course, meet, you know, the people who, you know, inspired her to make this journey.
That's a good way.
Yeah. So, again, let it be known that video games don't just teach people how to kill people. They do other shit too, like provisions and packing. And it's cool too, because when you read it, she treats it like a quest. Like, she actually says, like, I kind of have, like, a difficult time grinding this section of the freeway. You know, because there's nobody there. It's actually pretty cleverly written, and I actually like it. I like reading it, so. Anyways.
It's a good story.
It is. So, anyways, let's go into the emails that you guys sent us. Again, this is Party Chat, and if you want to participate in this conversation, the email address is partychat@gamerhorizon.com, partychat@gamerhorizon.com. So anyways, this first email is by Dumez from YouTube. So I'm just going to read this really quickly. In a previous episode, Alex said that by having a monthly fee on Xbox Live, that it is kind of good because you have an incentive to play online more. I kind of agree with the statement, but I also disagree, and I think this could be a very bad thing. Example, imagine if you wanted to toss a basketball into your net that you own outside your house, but we had a deal made where you must pay me $6 a month if you want to access your own net. Would you still say that it's kind of a good thing because you have an incentive to play basketball more? A separate point I'd like to make is about the fee itself. They charge $6 a month. Mind you, Microsoft is charging, I think, $14.99 a month for that package, right?
Right.
So, and they have a greater nerve for raising a price a bit ago like they did, which they did when they raised it from $50 to $60. In this economy, they should have lowered the price. If you did the math and calculate how much money they get from Xbox Live, it is sickening. If you compare to what running these servers versus the cash-in they bring, they should be charging enough to cover the cost and something extra to get a fair profit. Now, yeah, we'll get into dissecting this later. On one hand, I think that it is stupid to pay a fee for online games. Enough said. Because, of course, PC and PlayStation 3 owners already have it for free. Now, imagine if this same person had a PS3 and PC. They can buy a new game and actually try out multiplayer whenever they want. You know, now you may ask, why am I complaining? It's only $6 a month. Again, it's $14.99 a month. Well, a lot of people are very busy and don't have time to hop on multiplayer all the time, even if they are somewhat curious and would like to play sometime. But a lot of them probably don't want to play $6 a month, maybe not even play for about a month for multiplayer, and basically donating the cash to Microsoft. I personally would never buy an Xbox or any console that charges any fee whatsoever just to get the right to play online. The way that Sony does it, I think, is okay, and I have no problem with a fee being charged for some premium service, but not just for the right to play. Heck, you have to have purchased Xbox Live to use Netflix. If I was Netflix, I'd be pissed. The data stream doesn't even come from Microsoft servers, and Microsoft has nothing to do with the data stream. So, what do you think about this?
I agree with a lot of it.
Okay.
With a lot, to a degree. I think the problem that we're seeing now is, and this is an argument I used to use, but I'm not really sure, is you when you pay for Xbox Live, you pay for better servers.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I remember, I've run into my share. You know, to be honest, I played online on PSN and I played online on Xbox Live, and I don't think there's any really different. There's lag issues on both, I think.
Well, and here's
to a degree.
Yeah, okay.
To a degree. What I think it is that I think the Netflix thing is the biggest thing that pisses me off.
Mm-hmm.
I think that more so than anything else. I think, you know, I have my iPhone. I don't have to pay an extra service to watch it on there. My PC, same thing. Mm-hmm. My PlayStation, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Wii, for fuck's sakes, is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could watch all though on my Netflix on any of those without being a member of a certain service. And I'm already paying for Netflix. I think that's, you know, maybe the server thing isn't so much. That's my biggest pet peeve, is with premium services. You have to have Xbox Live to watch premium services that you already pay for.
Mm-hmm.
Examples include HBO Go as well. I'm already paying for HBO.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm already paying for it. Why do I have to pay more to watch it on this specific thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I can watch HBO Go on my my iPhone,
mm-hmm.
or even if I had an iPad, mm-hmm. or a computer. That's my point.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I think Dumbass actually misinterpreted what I said about Xbox Live. This is because taking Xbox Live by itself is unfair, because what we were actually talking about is Xbox Live in relation to making a console more affordable for somebody.
Right. Yeah. You know, I agree. And I was just talking about the Netflix.
Right.
I agree with
and,
you.
And I want to go into that later. But this is what as actually directly addressed to me. Xbox Live, which would subsidize a console, that is an interesting idea, but I'll tell you what, I will not do it because I can actually afford the whole console. But if somebody's friends are on Xbox Live, you can't tell me that you're gonna get a PS3 because it has free multiplayer. If your friends are on Xbox Live, you're gonna get an Xbox 360. I'm sorry. Like, unless you have friends on both, which is great, you know.
I think one of the most complex decisions for a gamer is when you do buy a console. Now, for me and you, mm-hmm. you know, it's a little bit different because we tend to buy everything.
Yes.
Okay. But for some people, there's different reasons. And saying just because you have to pay for online,
mm-hmm.
it gets a lot more complex because, let's be honest, when you buy one console, mm-hmm. and you focus on that one console, mm-hmm. it's no different than buying a car. You're trying to figure out the right car. Of course, granted, there's not as many choices. You know, mm-hmm. you only have maybe three key choices
mm-hmm.
for what you're going to buy. But there's a lot more than just online, you know. And having friends on Xbox Live is a key decision,
yes,
too.
Yes, it is very important. So, I mean, and Microsoft knows that right now they have a shit ton of people on their service, which is why they feel that they need to offer it in this way. Now, the other side of my argument was, and it wasn't really an argument, was that what if Sony used this to subsidize the next PlayStation, which, of course, you know, it's not in this email at all. Now, that would be an interesting idea, to subsidize a game platform so that it'll be cheaper, you know, and that's really what I was trying to get at. In terms of, you know, that whole news article and stuff, because remember that the way that we're talking about Xbox Live is not Xbox Live by itself. It is also part of a package deal where you can get the system for about $100 with a $14.99 plan for 2 years, you know? So, yes, you know.
And let's keep in mind, too, as much as I just knocked on Xbox Live to a degree, there are things that Xbox Live is more of a community console.
Mm-hmm.
Than any of the other consoles out there. It's you can form your own communities with the way that service is set up, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you had Halo Waypoint, which is actually a really good service when it was up. You have, you know, and they've been trying a lot of really different things as far as the online space for a while. Like, even, you know, watching Netflix with your friends and stuff. Like, you can't do that on. Well, do they, can you do that on Xbox Live? I kind of remember they used to actually have that. Like, they were kind of talking about it.
I don't know if you can do it now.
Yeah, I don't think they were talking about it at some point. But remember, like, back in the day, they were talking about, like, oh, you know, like, you know, you can watch a movie with your friends and stuff. I don't think that's possible anymore. But they've looked into you know, a lot more kind of ways to extend the online into a lot of different things and stuff that are, that's
remember
just,
1 versus 100 too.
Yeah, there was also that service, which was, you know, which is a great experiment. Failed, but good experiment.
I liked it. I thought it was a cool idea.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, though, and also the basketball analogy that he had, you know, not to be pedantic about it, that's kind of flawed because, you know, technically the servers that you're paying for on Microsoft aren't your servers. So it's not the same thing as you owning a basketball net and stuff and all that. Now here's the thing. I am not going to renew my Xbox Live Gold once it expires in a few months. And I am not a multiplayer gamer. So his point about the PC and PS3 gamers, like, you know, being able to go online and stuff like that, that holds true for me. I feel that over time, ever since the Xbox 360 debuted, I think they've diminished the value of having an Xbox Live Gold account. And that to me is very disappointing. Very, very disappointing. Like you said, they did have 1 versus 100 and all these really different and cool, like, kind of ideas, like Party Chat, which is what the name of this segment is. That is literally, you know, like an offshoot of a service that Microsoft does, you know, with, you know, the Xbox service. But
I don't like the direction Microsoft's going in some ways, but go ahead.
No, not at all. Because right now what's happening to us is that those kinds of features are becoming available on devices that you wouldn't think would be doing these things. Like when I talk to my friend Justin on Xbox Live, I don't talk to him on Xbox Live anymore. You know what I do? I Skype with him on my iPhone. I don't have to be on Xbox Live Gold to do that. And for that matter, I don't like playing online because guess what? Microsoft has not given me enough tools to be able to allow myself to be protected from the people who I don't want to play with.
Yeah, they don't have a good blocking system or anything.
Yeah.
It's feedback and stuff like that.
That feature has been consistent ever since the beginning of Xbox Live. And if you look at Sony, you know, I mean, obviously it's been mentioned, but Sony didn't start off the way that they did right now. Their service was terrible. They didn't even have like the stuff that they have right now. That is a glimmer of like what the PlayStation 3 was back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they didn't even have a store back in the day.
Let me ask you this. You're not going to renew Gold, right?
Yeah.
Are you going to renew PlayStation Plus?
Yes, and let me tell you why. It gives me free games.
Yep, that's why I got it too. Yep. And discounts.
Yeah, and discounts on DLC and everything. That to me is a, like, if Sony charges like, you know, like a monthly, like a monthly service for their new PlayStation 3 or their PlayStation 4, like let's say the PlayStation 4 is like $1,000 and maybe like if you sign up for like 3 years or something like that, you basically, I don't know, like you get it for $300. Like, I would gladly do it. Because I know what to expect from the service, and I know that they've been doing good as far as their consumers are concerned in regards to that. And it's not required for online multiplayer. So coming back to this, though, just to kind of shove it off, I do like the idea of subsidizing, and to be clear, I do like the idea of subsidizing the cost of a console with some sort of contract with a monthly fee to make it cheaper. However, with that said, Xbox Live's quality has decreased over the past few years.
I think the Xbox quality in terms of a lot of things have decreased in...
You know, well, we can talk, you know.
We'll talk about that, but yeah, I'm just saying they're not as strong as to me as they were, you know, earlier this gen.
Well,
so
they made it, they were strong because they had key people that basically defined what the 360 brand is. But those guys are gone. Robbie Bach, Ed Fries, you know, Jay Allard, you know, Peter Moore, those guys are gone.
Now it's the Kinect show.
Now it's the Kinect show. And I don't think they're doing a pretty good job, like, with the whole Kinect thing. And again, if it was purely, like, again, like, so just to recap, monthly payments to subsidize console, great idea. Xbox Live, not so much. Sony does it, or Microsoft does it next gen, most likely might be a consideration for me. You know, but either way, like, I'll probably buy the console unsubsidized because I can afford it.
Okay. So, do you have any more letters?
Yes, we do. Next one is by Lewis, and this is actually about Street Fighter Cross Tekken selling only 1.4 million. Again, to me, and this is, I'm reading it from his point. To me, I think it's unfortunate that it didn't sell, but I understand why. Before I give my thoughts about the situation, I am a gamer who likes fighting games. I'm not a tourney player, nor am I do I play competitive. Also, I'm not part, or do I want to be, or nor would I want to be part of the fighting game community. Nothing personal, but I take fighting. But sometimes they take fighting games way too seriously. When the game was announced or shown at San Diego Comic-Con 2010, I was hyped. I think it was cool and promising. Then when the DLC controversy came up, I was disappointed and refused to get the game at full price and waited for a price drop. I don't support the disc lock content, clever DLC, because to me, it sends a message that because the game is good doesn't mean the company can lock away things that are already on the disc. I prefer that it doesn't exist in the first place if Capcom is just going to put it on the disc. In my opinion, the DLC controversy is what made some consumers refuse to get the game. The other reason the game didn't sell 2 million is from the tourney players. They didn't like the aspect of the gems, even when Seth Killian explained it. With the DLC controversy not favoring to tourney players, contributing not selling 2 million, but I think 1.4 million still good, and that's my thought in this situation. So what are your thoughts? Well, first of all, Capcom already said it's because there's too many fighting games out there. Second of all, yes, the gem system is the issue. The gem system is broken in some ways that is even unexplainable. Like, you can't properly bring your gems to a tournament setting. What was Capcom expecting from that happening? I mean, obviously, you know, if it's not usable, the fighting game community is not going to use it.
Right.
You know, the fact that you have to make individual gems for every single freaking character and have it be different for every single character. There's a shit ton of characters in that game. That is so ridiculous. Like, I don't see how they gloss over that detail.
It's a fun game, but I don't think it has the balance issues mm-hmm. of, say, Marvel vs. Capcom 3, per se.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have issues. It's not, I'm not a tourney player, but I can tell you it's not tourney.
Well, the thing is, the gem system was used to balance the characters out, which is a terrible way to balance things out, especially if you don't build it for tournament play. You know, meaning
right.
you want it to be portable. You want to be able to go to another freaking console, different console, and be able to use those same settings on your platform. You don't want to spend hours and hours to set your character's gems before the match. The fighting game community is just not gonna deal with that BS. You know? And so guess what happened? Evo 2012, no gems.
No gems at all. And will that break the game?
Yes. There are some characters are completely unusable without the gems. If you play a slow character in the game, you're dead.
Right, right. Yeah, it's pretty insane that they're...
Yeah, because here's the thing with this game, okay? Stripping those gems away, the main thing about the game is all about rushdown. A lot of it is rushdown gameplay. Tekken is all about rushdown gameplay. There's no, like, you know, like, for the exception of some characters, you can probably, like, do keepaways, but for the most part, a lot of the characters are geared towards rushdown. If you are slow in any sort of way, you are dead. Because you need to be able to kind of, like, get around that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a way to disable gems?
Yes, that's what they're doing in Evo.
Okay, but in the game, because I couldn't find it.
I'm not sure. I think it's just, you know, you can just set no gems for everybody, maybe. I don't know. I haven't played the game in a while, but I know for a fact that there's probably going to be an option for it.
I might play a little bit of it. It's a fun game. It's not the best fighting game, but it is what it is. I don't take it overly serious. So.
Yeah, I have fun with it. That's the end of that. And to address the DLC controversy... We already talked about this earlier, but think about how much space that's going to take up on your hard drive before you complain about on this DLC.
Yeah.
You need to, there is kind of this. I mean, would you rather pay for the DLC and buy a new hard drive if your hard drive sells up, fills up rather, or would you just rather pay for a key that has the balance, variables and stuff in there with the DLC already in your game? It's a slippery slope, but it's like, to me, I don't want to pay for like an overpriced hard drive on my 360, and I don't want to fill up my terabyte PS3 hard drive, but that's just me. Like, I'd much rather have it on disk. And I am probably the only person that will say, like, yeah, I'd much rather have my DLC on disk, even though it sounds like it's sucky. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is sucky.
Yeah. His last question was, what are our favorite arcades? Family Fun Arcade is my favorite here in San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. I also like Round One, which is this arcade in Roland Heights. That's actually a really good arcade. It has bowling, karaoke, if you guys are curious and you live in the LA area and stuff and you want to hang out and stuff, I am actually having my birthday party there on a Saturday, so I am inviting listeners of the Gamer Horizon podcast. If you are in the LA area, join me. We'll have fun. We'll do stupid karaoke. We'll play some really crummy, like, we will play like the newly released like Rambo gun game by Sega. Yes, they released a Rambo arcade game recently.
Sega's still making arcade games?
Yes, just released a Rambo arcade game. I'm like, my head is exploding from that. But yes, they it's really interesting because there is a rage meter that you can build up and he will be invulnerable. And that just, wow. That arcade has it. Round One Arcade, Roland Heights. If you guys want to, I if you guys write in and say like, yeah, I want to go, like, I'll probably like, reveal some details about that. So, well, but yeah, how about you, dude?
Well, for me, I guess the best arcade I've been to is not open anymore. So what I will say is the best one that's open now. Mm-hmm. Is Arcade Amusements, and it's in Manitou Springs, Colorado, which is near Colorado Springs, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And what it is it's an old vintage arcade, and mm-hmm. this is an arcade that has games, and I mean, they have arcade games from the 1900s, and I mean penny arcade games.
Mm-hmm.
They have penny arcade games along with all the way to modern times.
Mm-hmm.
You will find tons of vintage arcade games. The last time I went there, they had a vintage Asteroids machine there.
Mm-hmm.
They have Space Harrier. It's a very old school arcade. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have everything from modern stuff that you would see, like dance DDR machines, mm-hmm. to, classic. They have a whole room of pinball games.
Nice.
I mean, it is a very old school arcade, and it's very cool. So,
mm-hmm. That's neat.
That's the best current arcade. Sadly, arcades aren't what they used to be.
Yeah. Well, if you ever come over here in California, I will show you Round One because it's really incredible.
Do they have beat 'em ups and stuff?
I don't remember, but there's a lot of shooting games, a lot of driving and shooting games, a lot of driving games, fighting games, and DDR games.
Nice. Although I'm not a big DDR fan, I'll have to take you to Arcade Amusements though.
Yeah, definitely. So, but thank you, Lewis, for the email. That was really awesome. This next one's by Derek. Now, Anthony, I don't know how we're going to answer this because it's kind of game specific.
Okay, bring it on.
Okay. I'm still playing Devil Survivor Overclocked, and I just finished the fifth day. The game's taking a little longer to play through than I was expecting, but it's still fun. This might be kind of spoilery and kind of weird too, but my question is related to comments made by the character Naoya, and how they're motivating me as I go forward through the remainder of the game. In the last battle of the fifth day, Naoya said he would share information if... Okay, I don't want to kind of... read this.
Okay, don't read it. I read the email and I know what
okay,
he's gonna ask.
I failed to do this and he left. But not before commenting on how he was disappointed in me. This caused two reactions. I am saddened and kinda pissed that I could not do as what he said, because I think he's kinda cool, even if you don't spend much time with him, and I wanted to get more information from him. Number two, as a result of reaction one, I felt driven to do something to prove Naoya was wrong to doubt my character's strengths and abilities. I basically want to show him that, yeah, I am a badass. Have either of you been motivated like this in a video game? Like, motivated showing another character that they were wrong for doubting you? As always, thanks for reading the email. I hope you both are doing well. Sincerely, Derek. Yes, Persona 4. With I.
Yep.
That was really... Because she's kind of like this loose cannon, kind of, you know, like this prissy girl and stuff who will really
use you.
I pursued all the girls. I had four girlfriends.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. You pursued... I had Chie. I had everybody.
Oh, damn.
I'm not going to talk about that more. But anyways, yeah, thanks, Derek. That was a good email. I is probably the character that I really wanted to kind of prove that I was a nice guy and stuff like that. And, you know, it didn't really get me far because she wanted a specific type of guy. And this is in Persona 4. So, it was pretty much that.
You want to impress video game characters.
For that particular purpose, yeah. I mean, I wanted to see how far I could take it. I think it's more along the lines of curiosity. Than, like, I wanted to impress a video game character.
Well, yeah, you want to find out what their reactions are going to be and stuff. That's
right.
I have to say I can't answer that because that's happened to me in numerous games, so.
Okay. So can you give me an example, though? Like, just for, you know, kind of conversation's sake?
Persona 3, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yukari. I remember there was this incident with some guys. I don't remember what exactly happened, but she got pissed off at me.
Yeah.
And she just... sort of, you know, stop talking to main character and
yeah,
and I had to impress her back to get her back into my, you know,
yeah,
little friendship thing. So
yeah, so that's kind of cool you know, because of the choices that we make in games and stuff, it becomes a lot, but it becomes a lot deeper and a more personal experience overall. You know, like, our gameplay would be different from your gameplay, et cetera, based off of our decision making. You know.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so that's pretty much all our emails, though. Thank you for Derek, Lewis, and Damez for all your emails. And, you know, can't wait to hear what you guys have to say in the next episode and stuff, if you guys ever write to us again. But anyways, if any of you guys out there want to email us and ask us any questions, maybe E3 predictions. If you guys have any E3 predictions, that would be fun to read on the air. Email us at partychat@gamerhorizon.com. Again, that's partychat@gamerhorizon.com. We will read your emails, as we always have. And remember that this week we are recording on Wednesday, and we're going to be recording every Wednesday moving forward, unless, you know, specified. You know, so that's really pretty much it for this episode, dude. Do you want to, say anything and stuff before we go?
No, I'm good. My YouTube channel, just go visit that, youtube.com/magus61. There you go. See me rant about stupid shit.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
And of course, you know, for me, I haven't updated my other podcast, so I'm not going to, like, you know, plug it. But you can find me on twitter.com/eternityinblack. I am pretty open as far as discussions are concerned. So follow me on Twitter. You will find me posting updates on and about the Gamer Horizon podcast as well. Follow the podcast at twitter.com/GamerHorizon. And of course, on GamerHorizon.com, we have a player. We have the email address. We have links to our iTunes, RSS feed, and of course, all our Twitter accounts all on there if you guys want to, like, check us out and stuff. And, you know, remember, Magus is also on, you know, twitter.com/Magus61.
Yeah, and I kind of caused a stir today on Twitter.
You always do.
Well, I said I really did today because I said I've always thought Rare was overrated.
Oh, Anthony, you're always starting some shit.
But hey, you agree with me on that, so.
Yeah, but I'm not, like, actively, like, spouting out, like, that's kind of like, you know, like, picking a fight, like, right there.
No, I'm just saying how it is. I don't like Rare, but we'll talk about that in another show. I think we have talked about it.
We have talked about it in another show, but that's just kind of like a random tweet, like, I don't like Rare games. And of course, you have, like, a whole bunch of Rare fans with their, you know, Viva Pinatas and stuff, like, coming towards you with their Viva Pinatas.
Oh, I said it even worse. I said to the people that say that Rare sucks now, I always thought they sucked. So,
Oh shit. Okay,
but we'll talk about that another time.
Yeah, but anyways, again, guys, partychat@gamerhorizon.com. Email us with all your questions and comments and whatnot. We loved all your comments this week and stuff. And, you know, thank you guys for, like, really listening to us for this incredible episode with the Gamer Horizon podcast. So until next week, we'll see you guys later.